Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the result is always positive. This program is dedicated to the exploration of the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the frosty desert tonight, or listening while at work on your computer, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and where we might be going than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. For the next 3 hours, you will be traveling safely beyond the limits of mortality. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Next week, we are going to have a surprise guest and open lines. We want to try and reach as many callers as possible and get a feel for the human spirit. We want you to know, who you would like to have on as a guest and what you think about great things happening in our world. We will post a poll on X Squared Radio, that's x2-radio.com, with various questions, and we would appreciate your feedback on those, and we'll incorporate that into the show. You can help us by, of course, answering that as honestly as you can and helping us out. We are entering into extremely important times, so your thoughts, your dreams of life and the future, and your will to act are most important. We want to make that known to the world, if we can. We also want to put out an open call to all POD authors. Those are print-on-demand authors. That includes AuthorHouse, Zulon, any of the other self-published authors that have a story of space, time, human development, or mystery about ancient civilizations. If you have a story to tell, write us and tell us about it. If we can, we'll give you a forum from which to tell your story and try to get you started in affecting the universe. We are trying to do something that has never been done before with this radio program to help keep people reading and supporting authors, because we need your creations. Tonight, we have the incredible honor and pleasure of having as our guest Michael Horn. He is the authorized American media representative for the Billy Meyer Contacts. Their website is theyfly.com, which he's been doing research since, 1979. And all of these contacts have been proven to be absolutely authentic. He's the writer, producer, and narrator of the new DVD, The Meyer Contacts, The Key to Our Future Survival. Does that sound interesting to everyone? He is probably the most well-known domestic source for information about the Pleiadians, also known as the Pleiadians, and their message for Earth. So please welcome with me Michael Horn. Good afternoon.
Hi, Brooks. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's absolutely my pleasure, and I appreciate so much the information that you sent me. I watched the DVD twice.
Oh, good.
I think I need to watch it two or three more times. There's so much information in there. There are several things that really arouse my faculties as an Earth explorer. I would like to say that I'm a universe explorer, but as far as I can tell, I've never been off planet, so I'm going to limit it to the Earth. I'd like to ask how you got involved with Billy Meyer. How did you find out about him or become involved with his story?
Well, actually, I walked into a bookstore in Los Angeles called the Bodhi Tree, and it's one of those, I call them physi-medical bookstores. They've got all sorts of, out there stuff, and books on health, UFOs, just about everything you can imagine, astronomy, astrology. And there was a coffee table size book, one of the photo kind of books that we're used to seeing. And I wasn't used to seeing this, though, because they had the clearest photographs of UFOs that I had ever seen up until that time, and frankly still. So I looked at that book, and I just had a sense that I was looking at something quite genuine. I bought the book, took it home, and, looked at it and read it and reread it and tried to glean every bit of understanding I could from it. It was limited. It was still fascinating. And it wasn't until about 8 years after that Let's see, was it 8 years? No, it was actually about 7 years after that. I was in a little town called Sedona, Arizona, and I was in a cafe with my daughter and some friends, and there was another guy in there sitting at the back of the cafe. We got to speaking. It turned out that he was a retired IRS agent. He and I ended up speaking about UFOs, and then the Meyer case came up, and he mentioned something that he called the contact notes, asked me if I had them. And I said I didn't even know what they were. And he said, well, those are the transcripts of Billy Meyer's conversation with these alleged extraterrestrials. And I said, wow, I sure would love to read those. And he said, well, when you get back to L.A., come up to Malibu, Decker Canyon area, and I'll make them available to you. I did, he did, and I had in my possession then about 1,800 and some pages of transcripts in kind of broken English, but nonetheless readable and quite fascinating, compelling, back and forth between this Billy Meyer and his alleged extraterrestrial contact people. And this documentation was from a period of time about between 1975 and 78. Since that time, I've read some better translations because those were a little rough. I've read everything else available in English. I go to Switzerland every year. I meet with Meyer and other people there, other witnesses, photographers, et cetera. And it's been, you know, lots, of course, of details during that period of time. That's kind of the overview version.
That's fascinating. So when you went to his house and he handed you the transcripts, were they loose leaf? Were they in a notebook? Were they bound? Or?
They were at that point, what I guess you'd say they were like either mimeographed or early Xeroxed, you know, probably Xeroxed at that point, actually. And with a, I'm trying to remember, I think they were just like, you know, punch hole things with brads through them. They were very basic. They were translated, we found out, by someone who was not, what do you call it, very, very knowledgeable about how to construct English. But he translated everything, you know, pretty literally. So it was, you know, these loose leaf, you know, bundled together kind of blocks of 100 pages each or so. There were about 18 volumes of them.
Well, I think you've kind of followed the same path of excitement that perhaps I did. I guess I've been fascinated with UFOs and spacecraft since I was a little kid. And, you know, I'm early 50s now, so I guess we grew up in that age. But that, of course, seems to be the center focus for a lot of people, the UFOs, the spacecraft, the drive technology, you know, where do they come from, and very little about, you know, who are they and what is their message.
Right.
And I'm going to sort of capitulate right now and just say that perhaps there are many sources of UFOs and many sources of alien stories, but none have the detail and the apparent involvement with a single human contact for the purpose of trying to change the course of humanity, like this story. That's why it's so fascinating to me. So, when you picked up the manuscripts and you read through them, what aspect about them most fascinated you?
Well, what was striking immediately was the conversational nature of them, and that they were very different from even the so-called New Age and channeled material that was floating around, you know, just starting around at that time, mid-80s. For instance, they were totally devoid of things like, "Greetings, we are the Space Brothers, come to you in love and light to let you know that you are a master walking upon your plane of experience," and similar. There was none of that. It was very direct. They spoke logically. They either knew things or they didn't. In the entire volumes of material that I've read, I've only seen them use the two words together, "I" and "believe," once. When one of the, and I'll just say alleged one more time. It's up to people to, you know, of course, figure this out for themselves. But when one of the alleged ETs said to Meyer something to the effect of, "I believe the name of the woman you're thinking of is so-and-so, and she lives in Austria." Other than that, they don't speak about beliefs. They speak about what they know and what they don't know. And they speak very often very harshly and directly, which has upset a lot of people that think that we should be coddled and spoken to in flowery terms. And This is one of the bones of contention that a lot of people have, because they perceive some of the direct and even harsh information in the Meyer case as being quote-unquote negative, anti-American, anti-this, anti-that, when it's simply what they have to say.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, you know, the truth, they say it, it'll set you free, but it isn't always easy to take.
Well, one of the things that, when I go to conventions or speak to groups and then have question and answer afterwards, people try to discover what is so important about the fact that we've divided up our world into races, into nations, and you know, we still battle each other over simple things like real estate or water or food or whatever, when we certainly have the technology to transcend that. And yet we are visited by races who communicate with us intelligently and speak to us as a single species.
Mm-hmm.
And what I initially found fascinating about the Billy Meyer story is that he appears to be the single contact that the Pleiadians had on this planet. They, if they did communicate with others, they didn't make it known to Billy, and the work that they did with others never came forward like the work they did with Billy.
Mm-hmm.
So what I find fascinating is that the contacts spread over such a long period of time, and Billy evolved with those contacts, and the nature, or should I say, the depth and complexity of the information conveyed by those contacts increased over time,
mm-hmm.
which really speaks to their authenticity.
Yes, and I should add, actually, regarding him being the sole contact person for this race, it's true, but actually, he wasn't the only one they did contact in the process.
Ah.
He was, well, for those that don't know, his story is kind of interesting because his contact started when he was only 5 years old. And they were at first telepathic contacts and then physical, face-to-face, voluntary contacts with an ET named Svath. And what we come to find out after a while is that there was a parish priest named Father Zimmerman. And Father Zimmerman had been prepared and contacted prior to Meyer being contacted. And this is really a remarkable story. And he was contacted so as to be able to be prepared for when young Meyer would eventually come to him, a bit perplexed and uncertain and needing some reassurance about these unusual experiences he was having, these contacts with an extraterrestrial person. And this parish priest was apparently open-minded enough and capable of having this interaction himself. Now, Meyer grows up in a, you know, a small Swiss village, rural, conservative, religious, and yet the parish priest was somehow free enough in consciousness to be able to embrace the idea that he himself was in contact with a human being from another world who was preparing him for you know, yet another mind-blowing experience when one of the children in his you know, in his parish, in his village, would be coming to him seeking some counsel. And indeed, that is what occurred. Then there is, in this case, another remarkable thing. When Meyer is already a young man traveling around, and he is in India in 1964, he spends time at an ashram there. And at the ashram, it's a Buddhist monastery or ashram, and the head of the ashram is a monk who has in his charge two young sisters who are granddaughters of his. And Meyer, there are photographs of, I think we may have a couple on the website, and there's some links from my site where people can see some of the early UFO photos of Meyer's and more information about this. But at the time, he was photographing up to eight of the craft at a time hovering above the ashram, and he claims that he was meeting and speaking with one of his contact persons. In 1998, a woman came forward who's a now retired UN diplomat. She'd been with the Cambodian mission at the UN General Assembly there for about 14 years. She's now retired and married, and she gave a public presentation, which was videotaped, And she said, I need to come forward at this time, somewhat reluctantly, because I value my privacy. However, I've been contacted by people. Now they're asking me about a Mr. Billy Meyer because they know that I was in a particular, you know, ashram with my grandfather. Well, let me just tell you that I know Mr. Meyer. He's a truthful man. I saw him when I was there with my sister at our grandfather's ashram. I saw these craft that would hover in the sky, and I saw the woman that would come and talk to him. Yes, this is an amazing thing. And she says, she would even come into my room at night sometimes and just sit there and stroke my hair as I would fall asleep. She said, you may understand that I've been somewhat reluctant to, you know, discuss this publicly. I left it behind me very much when I left the ashram and went into my educational, you know, role and then into the UN. But it really is required that I come forward and vouch for him. So it was quite an amazing thing. She's definitely one of the witnesses in this case. And,
unexpected validation.
Yes.
Of the early story.
Exactly.
That is great. So, no, how long now? Say, I guess he started having contacts when he was 5, telepathically, and then how many years did that go on? Like over 60 years?
Well, the contacts continue to this day with various persons from these groups. So it's 64 years, a little more than 64 years already that his contacts have been happening. And at different times with different people, there were times when the contacts would be suspended for a period of time while he simply went about and lived his life and did what he had to do for a period, even for, you know, a period of years, but they always resumed at certain times. So he, to this day, has the contacts with these people.
I, of course, have not read all the transcripts, but is there a mention of why they decided at that time to come forward? And I guess we'll get more into the fact that we are, in fact, eternal intelligences or beings, and we have lived, you know, many hundreds or thousands or even millions of lives.
Right.
And so it may have been that, you know, Billy Meyer has always had contact with him. We just don't know. But did they mention why?
Sure.
Billy and why at that time?
Sure. You're kind of onto it there. So let's just give a caveat here, and let me say this, and maybe I'll say it a few times just so in case anybody misses it. I divide the case in terms of what I speak about into two categories. That which is factual, meaning I can prove it's true and it's real,
mm-hmm.
and I can direct people to being able to validate or vet that information for themselves. There is the other part of it, which I call speculative, meaning I have no way of proving the information. It may be that it is dealing with things that are too far in the past, too far in the future, not yet accessible to us scientifically or in other ways. But, you know, that kind of will cover most of it, just can't prove it. So speculative. So with that having been given, let me just say that what's said in the case is this, as you alluded to it, we are eternal beings. We are human beings, not that our personalities, our, you know, current incarnations endure forever. We know we have plenty of evidence that that doesn't happen. The lifespan of a human being right now is actually relatively short if we take the information in this case to be at all accurate, that these people, for instance, that Meyer meets with may live 1,000, 1,200 or more years. So the part of us that they say is the eternal, immortal part is what they call the human spirit. And not the soul, which they say exists, but that the soul, which has its residence, primary residence, if you will, at the solar plexus, is a transitory structure or essence that comes together anew in each lifetime with the personality, with each, you know, new personality and body that we take on, we form and develop a new quote-unquote soul.
Mm-hmm.
But the spirit, which they say resides in a certain portion of the brain while we're alive, is this eternal immortal part that they claim that they, these Pleiaran extraterrestrial human beings, are able to actually follow, identify, chart, whatever you want to call it, with technology that they possess so that they can identify a given spirit and even know what or, you know, slash who its previous incarnations were. So what we're stating here is that according to them, reincarnation is a fact of life. The closest I can come to it in my hopefulness is to say, reincarnation, don't worry about dying, you'll live through it. Now, they have some other info that may go beyond that, but we can't prove it. Right now, we either believe it or we don't, or we think about it. So in this context, it is said in this material that Meyer's spirit, his, you know, eternal immortal essence, is an enormously ancient spirit that had actually, if we can conceive of this, gone through all of the incarnational experiences a human being has before the spirit moves into the lower levels of the quote-unquote higher spiritual, the spiritual worlds.
Mm-hmm.
Not the higher levels that, you know, it takes zillions of years too, but the lower levels of the spiritual worlds, which means a very highly developed, highly advanced spirit form that is no longer incarnating physically, has no longer a need for a body, and has moved on. And, you know, I'm just kind of reporting this information as I understand it. I am no expert on any of that. However, it is said that this particular spirit was kind of called back into incarnational patterns, voluntarily, agreed to come into incarnations again, to a great degree because of the misdirections and dangerous path that humans, especially on Earth, were on due to extraterrestrial influences over many, many, many eons in the past, not the least of which and being some of the more recent experiences with extraterrestrials who were formative entities for our religions, even for altering races of humans in their development on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a little long-winded, but I'm just trying to give, you know, a kind of an idea. So what they're saying is this particular spirit form, having the experience and level of development that exceeded most, you know, all terrestrially originating spirits, volunteered for this gig, which is basically a pretty thankless one when you look at prophets, at whatever happens to them when they come to the planet. And there has been some different lineages of prophets. Meyer's spirit is with a particular lineage of prophets, and his is said to be the last incarnation as a prophet for this spirit, for this world, if I understand the information correctly. Now, I don't know if that helps anybody to hear all that stuff.
Oh, it helps immensely.
Oh, good. Okay.
Listeners to this program are exposed regularly to various anthropological developments of mankind and ancient races having involvement with off-worlders and their influences. Mm-hmm. And we can certainly see commonality in many religions, both Christian and non-Christian, that go all the way back to those roots. But one of the interesting things that you said, and I kind of clued in on, was that that Billy had voluntarily, or maybe through some agreement, decided to come back for one more mortality, shall we say, in order to correct a course. And one of the things I personally believe is that there have been other grand civilizations on this planet that have followed a similar course to a point of warfare and either destroyed each other through actual war genetic breakdown or germ warfare or even cataclysm from outer space. It's just hard to tell. But I agree, and I think most of the listeners agree, that we are on a wrong course, that the tensions that continue to build on this planet and the weapons that we continue to develop are formidable enough to render all life, you know, gone on this planet. And so I think as far as timing, the Pleiarians coming 64 years ago would certainly bring them here before the first modern atomic weapons were used. And I understand that in Meyer's writings or in early contacts, there were warnings about this kind of weaponry being used and abused. And, of course, the fact that, you know, the United States was the first to actually use the weapons, we're certainly not the only ones that own them,
right,
or have the motivation to use them. And so certainly we're there's a general feeling that we're sitting on the edge of a knife, as it were, with not so stable humans having their finger on the proverbial button.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of what you've just said is, you know, it's very interesting you put it that way, because a number of things. Number one, when Meyer came in, you know, into this incarnation, he had been incarnating on this planet for some time in the process of these, you know, incarnations as different prophets, according to them. He will continue to incarnate here until a certain point. He will have to, you know, he's doing evolution all over again, in effect. So it's not just like a quick visit, hi, folks, see you later. So he's a human being. He has to go through everything that everybody else does, and he is clearly, that's it. He is a human being. So there's nobody to, you know, out there, and just for people listening, there's nobody here to worship or, you know,
right.
Get all upset about one way or the other. In terms of what you're saying about the Pleiaren, actually, they have had bases on the planet for some time. Their forefathers were here long ago. Some of their forefathers were, you know, on the benevolent side, and some of them were not, and they misled people and were, you know, instrumental in leading astray through the formation of what the Pleiaren referred to as cultic, you know, erroneous cultic religions. And there are a lot of things in here that are, you know, obviously, they'll be very troublesome for people to read. Now, when you speak about the civilizations and atomic weaponry, they've talked about the pre-atomic and other types of destructions upon the planet that have gone back for some time. According to them, there have been extraterrestrial visitors coming and going here in one way, shape, or form for literally millions of years. There's no traces left of some of them. Perhaps there's still some traces to be found. There were travelers that came here, set up civilizations. They went the way of, you know, that you spoke of, where they entered into conflict and destruction, or they may have just left the planet at some point. Sometimes their technology failed them if they came here and they had not yet established a whole civilization, but something breaks down in their technology, they can't leave the planet anymore, and they are in a primitive, you know, pristine world with no manufacturing, and they will then degenerate into wild tribes just in the course of survival. Kind of you get a bit of a backward evolution that way. So there's so much in this case that's, you know, kind of challenging for our thinking, but that encompasses a lot of the things you were just speaking about.
Well, one of the things that I probably find when I see the look of confusion upon people's faces when you say something like, well, of course we're not alone in the universe. I guess mainstream modern religions or social mores have pretty much made, well, they've decided that the sane thing to do is to claim that we are alone in the universe, that there's no such thing as aliens or UFOs, and that somehow we crawled forth from some primordial ooze, or we were just simply created out of dust, and we're here to do one mortality, and we're finished.
Yeah.
That's sort of the mainstream view of things. But when I look at the overwhelming evidence, and certainly Billy Meyer's evidence is, to say that it's mind-blowing is an understatement. Mm. The clarity of the photographs, I'm looking for a word. The organization of the contacts and publishing them so that they are established by a third party as being authentic, so that when future events come to vindicate those claims, you've got a third party that says these thoughts have already been given. All of this evidence, and we're going to go into much more of that in the second hour, seems to refute the standard claim that we're alone in the universe, there's nobody else on this planet that's intelligent and breathing air other than us.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the questions does come up often. If the Pleiarens have visited us so often and for so many, maybe millions of years, where are they now? I mean, do they reside somewhere on planet, or do they continually leave and come back?
They claim that they were based here for some time, but they are no longer having any bases on the planet. Yeah, that there are no longer any bases on the planet whatsoever. They had three and these bases have been closed up and abandoned, and we will not even find their remnants. They're claiming that they no longer, for various reasons, need to have bases. They've completed the part of this mission that required them to kind of be based here. And the greater amount of information for us has already been given to Meyer, and he's already transcribed it. Even though contacts continue and there is always more information, the greatest bulk of it that will, according to them, be developed and explored over the period of 700 to 800 years is already here. And, you know, that was Meyer, one of, you know, Meyer's main missions was to get all this stuff down, transcribed. So,
well, I guess I don't know whether to be afraid, like they've given up and they'll just wait till the next creation, or they've already given us everything we need and the energy is set in motion and all we have to do now is execute.
Well, you know, the bottom line is it's up to us.
Yeah.
And the core of this case is, as we look at, you know, what's it about and what can we do and all this, as we, you know, get into visiting that any number of times, more of the case is truly self-responsibility. And for a lot of people that are into ideas about, you know, pardon me, ascension and moving into another dimension and harvests and space brothers and all this stuff, the perspective from the Meyer case is, I'm sorry, but it's nonsense.
Yeah.
You know, it's not happening. No matter what you want to spin in terms of these things to make yourself feel good, it comes down to that which is, in a sense, predictable. We are living as subject to and or conscious, you know, creators along with the laws of cause and effect. So we don't get a pass. We don't get the slate wiped clean because, oh, the planet's going to raise its vibration and all the good people are going to go over here and the bad people are going to be plucked off and taken somewhere else. It's not like that. We wouldn't learn. Nobody learns by being relieved of their responsibilities on any level. So when we look at and get into the ideas and the teachings that the Pleiaren have, you know, disseminated to Meyer and he publishes and all, you're going to see at the heart of it is this, you know, truthfulness and self-responsibility. It's like the core of the matter. And from that, everything else stems. And of course, there are some philosophical, we might call them philosophical spiritual teachings, which are enormously important and are really the meaning of the case if you get down to it. But as far as any mechanism for understanding and dealing with the information and dealing in a practical way with our world, they have put it out there. And lo and behold, it's not terribly fancy.
Yeah. And the thing is, it has a ring of truth about it. It has the firmness of an eternal thought. It's not something ethereal or mysterious. It's pretty plain and simple.
Yep.
And as we interpret our universe through our five senses, two of mine are pretty much wearing out, sight and hearing. But we have an imagination. Maybe we have a way of sensing our universe through other than the five normal senses of which I speak. But the fact is that we are interpreting our universe through a mortal vessel.
Mm-hmm.
And its limitations are perhaps the very things that make this existence so sweet.
Yeah.
And the fact that we're capable of such wonder and such love and creation and gentleness and growth and intelligence and learning and creation, we're also capable of terrible evil and death and mayhem and pain. And these things, although good experience, we're certainly learning, are not desirable. And I think we're trying to avoid those as a race, but nevertheless, we can't just say, well, we're going to treat each other decently over here, and we're not going to worry about you guys over there on the other side of the ocean for now. Mm-hmm. But eventually, they're going to come over here and wreak evil and pain and death upon us. And so we're kind of at a crossroads as a race. We've reached the point now where even rogue forces can have tremendous, as you say, cause and effect. They can have great effects on the planet and on the civilization.
Absolutely. And when you get into reading the Meyer material, if you read the what are called the Henoch or Enoch prophecies, which people can read for free just from linking from my front page, you'll see that long ago they have been foretelling, unfortunately, just those kinds of effects for the world and for the USA specifically. And when I started to first read the material in 1986, and I read some of the things that were, you know, very prescient in speaking about great trouble coming to the U.S. and wars and what have you, and even this thing about the attacks in Paris, I read that in 1986. The first time he published about in 1981, he had published about, you know, arson and looting and burning in Paris, and the inhabitants will be the ones. And in 87, he said that this will be, the people will actually be the, you know, of the Islamic faith who will do this. And they kind of spelled it out. Now, Paris has not been burned to the ground, which is one of the warnings in there, but it did encounter some rather serious upset, and we don't know that it's over. Hopefully, the French have figured out and learned whatever they need to start to work these problems out so that they're not going to become ever, you know, ever more literally incendiary. But as far as we're concerned here, when I was reading this material, because I was also not ever a particularly politically interested person, and in the 80s I was not even that aware, frankly, of a greater drama in the world beyond the, you know, a few news headlines, just to be honest. Mm-hmm. So it would upset me to read this stuff, and I thought, well, this doesn't sound right. This is kind of crazy. You know, I'm not so sure I can buy this stuff in the Meyer material. Well, as time has gone on, we're seeing an awful lot of this playing out. And on top of it, I found a website that I had then put a link to in one of my newsletters. Somebody had gone to the trouble to list, I think, over 200 unprovoked attacks that had been conducted in our name as Americans against other countries, by definition, none of whom had ever attacked us. And that means that we had invaded, destabilized, overthrown their governments, bombed them, declared war on them, installed, you know, puppet regimes, whatever, and none of these people had attacked us. So, but based on the laws of cause and effect, what can we expect except ultimately, and in its own way and timing, a return of an energy that we send out to other people? So we can put this in any kind of fancy language we want. We could pretend that we can pray it away to whatever deity we happen to think is floating around up there. We can ignore it, what have you. But cause and effect is a dumb law. It is impersonal. It doesn't care. It simply says, oh, you send this out, I send it back. So it's expressed very nicely in a couple of, you know, biblical passages that I can paraphrase. I probably won't get them exactly right. You know, as a man soweth, thus shall he reap, she, he, they, whatever. And as, you know, you do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Well, that is cause and effect that we were being taught there. And if all the religions on the planet simply were centered around that concept in those phrases and any other variations of the theme, as above, so below, whatever, we probably wouldn't be anywhere near in as much trouble as we are now.
I cannot disagree with that. I have traveled not as extensively as I have dreamed to, but I certainly see the results of imperialist, and I don't just mean United States. I mean, there are other nations.
Sure.
As I travel in Mexico, I see the results of Spanish imperialism as they came over and literally destroyed a sentient and wonderful people,
yep,
a creative and advanced people, and destroyed their knowledge as heretical. And I certainly see the results of that in other nations where, as you say, we play with their policies and with their monetary abilities, and support those governments that support us and destabilize,
right,
those governments that destabilize us based on, oh, who knows what, oil or religion or wheat or bananas,
right,
who knows. But all of that is the work of a very few planning people, but the vast majority of us, I feel, at least as I go around and interview people, feel like you and I, that, yeah, there's a United States, there's an America, but then there are Americans, there are human beings. And,
that's right.
And largely what I see are people that want to live life full and want to reach the fullness of their potential. And, you know, maybe through lack of access or lack of opportunity are unable to do so. But we do have a caller on the line. Caller, where are you calling from?
Hello there.
Yes, hello. How are you?
Is this Dr. Agnew?
This is he, and Michael Horn, my guest.
Michael?
Hi.
I can barely hear you.
Well, that's all right. We're having some technical difficulties, but we can hear
okay,
you.
Okay, and Dr. Agnew, you're there? Hello?
What is your question?
Okay. Well, Dr. Agnew, this is Gary Larson in Utah. And I know you know who I am.
Yes.
I've been on the other, I had a hard time finding you because I was on X Squared Radio, and I just happened to call and they told me how to get over here to BVS.
Oh, that's all right.
Now, I understand that what you're doing right now is you're talking about aliens and about, I really probably because I cannot even hear your responses, and I'm assuming that you can hear mine because I'm, in other words, it's like a one-way conversation for me because you're just so down in the low there.
I apologize for this. Now,
oh, wait, that's better.
Okay, well, what I'm going to try
to do
is...
Don, my producer. He might be able to relay what I say to you.
Well, let me try to adjust the levels a bit.
Okay.
Okay. Who is that that just spoke up?
That's Don, my producer.
Okay, now somebody's talking now.
Okay, that's me, and I'm the producer, but let me try to adjust the levels.
Okay.
All right, Gary, did you have a quick question?
Okay, have you heard of George Adamski?
George Adamski?
Yeah, back in the 50s, he wrote a book called Inside the Ships.
I'm not familiar with it. I don't know if Michael...
Well, George Adamski, he had some experiences with aliens, and this, of course, was the hot spot, you know, back in the late 40s, early 50s. I worked on the top of a mountain here in Salt Lake on a TV transmitter site with a contemporary of this George Adamski, and he told me some very interesting things that had happened in relationship with his being taken aboard a ship and taken up into a mothership and what they experienced there. Now, have you had any such experience where you've been taken aboard a ship or been in contact with an alien?
I have not. How about you, Michael?
No.
Sir, can you relay to me his response?
As far as what your guest is, your caller is speaking about, I've heard the Adamski case. A lot of people have been interested in it, but the problem for me with the Adamski case is there's virtually zero content. We don't know whether he was seeing actual terrestrial objects, if there were some models that he was employing or not. But more importantly, there was nothing of any substance that has ever been brought to my attention.
I'm going to get off the phone here and go back on the radio where I can hear your response hear anything.
Right. Don, I think we're having a little trouble with that call.
Yeah, you're so far down in the mud that I can't hear you, so I'm going to go listen to you.
All right. Thank you, Gary.
Okay, I apologize for that.
Right.
This new equipment, now, for some reason, it was working last night, but every time I have a... callers. For some reason, their lines are so different and the equipment's so new, I don't know quite yet how to work it, unfortunately. It's a sophisticated little piece with just too many darn knobs.
We'll work through it together.
Exactly.
All right, we'll get back to our program. Actually, I'm going to take about a 3-minute commercial break. Let me pay some bills, Michael, and then we'll take a little musical break. If you want to get a drink of water, you can do that. We'll come back right at the top of the hour.
I'll be here.
All right.
Thank you.
Have you been to the Discovery Store lately? If you go to X Squared Radio and click on the Discovery Store sign, you'll be amazed at the prices they have on the world's best telescopes. Everyone is excited about star and planet watching. Did you know that most of the comets named in the past 50 years were found by amateurs? Listen, those big publicly funded telescopes have their time bought and paid for. They're not looking for anything new and dangerous. It's up to explorers like you and me. So go to the Discovery Store and get your telescope as soon as you can. Who knows? You might save the planet or find the next great comet. So visit the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio. Also, I want to let you know that the Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, 2012, and the Harvest of the End Times is now off the presses. The first order has been shipped and will arrive any day now. It can be purchased, of course, at arkofmillionsofyears.com. Make sure you spell that with a K, like Noah's Ark, or by visiting your favorite bookstore. They should be able to order it for you, and it'll be available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble online in about a month. So the only place you can get an autographed copy is through the website. If you've enjoyed Volume 1, which clearly explained the creation of the Earth, you'll need Volume 2 to explain why we are here and where we are going from here. And if you want to know where the Ark of the Covenant is being held, or how the Sumerian language was found in Bolivia, or how ancient texts testify that off-worlders visited ancient peoples in South America, you need to read this book. My co-author, E.J. Clark, and I have, for the first time, uncovered information you have never seen before. There is no doubt that off-worlders have been involved with the development and recovery of mankind after a series of cataclysms. So get your copy today at arkofmillionsofyears.com. We'll take a short musical break, and we'll be right back. So what's your new equipment, Don?
Okay, for some reason... You know, you hear me? For some reason, I hooked this equipment up wrong, I think.
We'll figure it out next week.
Yeah, it's just so new, and I've got so much equipment, and I needed to do this for the studio to get, and, yeah, it's, I don't understand why it's doing this, but do I ever read instructions? No. I'm like Tim the Tool Time.
Well, you read that afterwards. You'll know what the directions mean. Did you get my message about Samson Orion, about his archives?
Oh, by the way, we have a guy working full-time on the archives. We'll have them all up soon. All of them. And there won't be any more delays. And I got your email on how to split up the 3 hours. I'll do that too.
Okay.
Positive light, I guess. You probably got school to think of.
We can go on the air anytime now. I'm just wondering if we might want to take like 30 minutes. You know? Do you want, like, maybe your next 30 minutes and I can rehook this up? We don't have to.
Next week will be a protection.
Done. You got it.
Okay.
Okay, I'll put you on the air after the countdown.
Very good. And welcome back, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. Remember, in here, the results are always positive. We are having some adventure trying to take some telephone calls. My producer has installed some brand new sophisticated equipment. And, well, you know how we are with reading instructions. We'll do it later. So we might not be able to take any more phone calls this week, but next week we will be able to. And so just try to listen in, and if you have questions, feel free to email us. And for sure, call in next week because we're going to have open lines and a mystery guest, and we'll go over all of these. We also want to thank you very much for the heartfelt words that people have sent us about Samson Orion. As you know, last week, March 5th, we had just a fantastic interview with a wonderful human being and author, Samson Orion. We had a great three-hour interview about his book, Manifest Zero. And, of course, you can get that at Amazon or Barnes & Noble or going through our website. And shortly thereafter, the next, I think that Tuesday, he had an unfortunate car accident and was killed. And we are just heartbroken over that. We do know that life is short and that everything we do will eventually affect the universe. And we've had our tears, and now we have our joy that he lives on. And we will have his words posted on the website for archives for you to enjoy and to remember. A great a great soul and artist, Samson Orion, and our hearts go out to Susan, his lovely wife. So with that, we will welcome back our guest, Michael Horn. We are talking about the Billy Meyer contacts and his DVD, Michael Horn's DVD, The Key to Our Future Survival, The Meyer Contacts. And also, you can get all of this information and arouse your faculties and open your mind and your imagination and overcome all your preconceived notions by going to theyfly.com. And we'll have a link to that on our website at X Squared Radio as well. And that website, by the way, is x2-radio.com for those of you that are not familiar with them. Welcome back, Michael.
Thanks, Bruce. Glad to be back.
All right. So we had our our technical adventure already tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Gary, for the question, and we'll try to answer that in a little more detail. Now, one of the things that makes the Meyer contact so unique and so powerful, so compelling, and to the point where a great individual like Michael Horn will walk into a bookstore and see a book full of photographs so clear and so believable that his entire life has been affected by it, and thus thousands, maybe millions of other lives have also been affected by it. The thing that makes the Meyer contact so unique is the credibility, the thought and forethought and planning that went through, that Billy Meyer went through in order to make his work actually bulletproof. Don't you agree with that?
Yes, I would have to agree with that. There has been nothing but endless attack on Meyer and you know, his physical evidence for a long, long time on his character. People have attacked him, and there have been 21 assassination attempts on his life that have been witnessed and documented. It's a rather sad commentary on humanity that the man who's, you know, basically come to take on a task for our benefit, if you will, has been so, you know, vilified and harassed. But human beings throughout history have always demonstrated that, for the most part, we're, you know, a bit short-sighted and small-minded. But he has passed virtually every, you know, test. All of the skeptics that claimed that his photographs and films were hoaxed, when they were challenged to duplicate them, they couldn't, and they still can't. They can make very nice little photos of UFO models, but they clearly cannot duplicate what Meyer has, because Meyer's photos and films, when tested, were shown to be large objects, not models, not special effects. Everything was done before home computers and Photoshop and all of that. He has sound recordings and metal samples, and, you know, it just goes on and on. But for some reason, people, in terms of, you know, the masses, are a little bit resistant to learning and feel threatened by things that are outside of their immediate frame of reference often.
I think maybe that's what we want to kind of explore. Why is it that races, I guess more modern races, and by modern I mean the last 4,000 years, we're afraid of this extraterrestrial contact. We're afraid of even admitting that it exists, and we classify people who claim that they've seen it or heard it or read about it and believe in it as heretics. But of course, prior to that time, if you go way back, maybe to the Lemurians or the Atlanteans or ancient Aztecs, the Mayans and Toltecs, it was quite commonplace for them to have interaction with off-worlders. They wrote about it, they drew it, they carved it, they made no bones about it. But it seems like the last 4,000 years, it's like anything that smacks of anything that's not made here, we don't want to hear about it.
Well, it's a kind of a mixed bag. I'll tell you why. The paradox is when you read the Meyer material, I have an article on my website about it, a translation of one of Meyer's contacts. They say, certainly in the histories, they say, yes, of course, you've had extraterrestrials here, you know, forever and all. However, they're stating that most of what we now see during this period of time, and even going back a few decades, isn't of extraterrestrial origin. They take a dim view of, for instance, the idea that everybody and their brother and sister is being abducted by little bug-eyed guys, and that, you know, hybrid babies are being churned out by the millions, and that some extraterrestrial race needs our genetics, kind of an illogical thought, if you consider how we are short lifespans, highly aggressive beings, and our genetics are not exactly what, you know, anybody should be seeking to utilize. We should be improving our genetics, not exporting them. And I don't think that, I don't think most of this stuff is happening. Certainly not to the magnitude that people believe, but what they have said is that we have to also not transfer our power out to every idea of something being extraterrestrial, whether it's a negative or a positive, idea. It's elaborate stuff. Just when you feel like you can be comfortable with something in the Meyer material that's going to make you say, well, you see, that's exactly what I think or I believe. Then you read something else that goes, well, wait a minute, that's challenging this other thing that I think is true. So it's a great pond.
Well, when I think about the incredible organization that's in the whole story, all the evidence over literally decades, it's like the contacts are time-stamped, and then they're validated by a third party, which would be the Copyright Office. And in order to authenticate the contact and the fact that the Pleiarians did exist, they did in fact give him physical evidence, like the metal.
Right.
There was some metallurgical work done on this metal sample. Can you tell us a little
about
that?
Right. Well, let me just go back a second just to be as precise as I can about how, you know, the copyrights and what have you.
Yeah.
There is a good amount of Meyer material that he published that's in books prior to the occurrence of the events foretold. On the other things where there's volumes of information and it foretells events that haven't occurred or discoveries or what have you, these are documents that are indeed dated and, right down to when the time that the contact started, on which particular date, and everything everybody said. The words that are spoken by the ETs are always, their sentences are numbered. And Meyer at first didn't understand the logic of why he had to type a number next to each sentence that they spoke. And they said, here's the reason. We're going to give you a tremendous amount of information. In future times, people are going to accuse you of hoaxing. That is, they're going to say that you simply went and backdated things to make these things look prophetically accurate. And the protection you'll have is that every sentence that we speak will be numbered. And all of the copies of this that are disseminated, whether they're in German and then in English and other languages, all of the sentences number, you know, contact number 102, you know, sentence 26 spoken by so-and-so, it's all going to be the same. So it would be by logic, it'll show that it's impossible for you, Billy Meyer, to have gone and altered these things and backdated them or anything else, because they're going to be out there. And every time he does type up the transcript, it's witnessed by somebody and they sign off on it, then it's disseminated. So there's a nice, very common sense, you know, means of assuring authenticity and date and what have you for those things that didn't get into copyright offices.
Now, when you say type up, you actually mean type up, don't you? Not a word processor, but a typewriter.
Well, most of it was up until he finally got a computer I guess about 6 years ago. He started off on a manual typewriter, and then it was an electronic typewriter.
Well, so for 58 years, well, not, maybe not that long, he had been writing these things down. I used to use a typewriter. I'm old enough to remember an old typewriter, but
right.
Even with the keys, you just don't go back in and insert a thought. I mean, it's a matter of having to retype the entire document.
That's
and
right.
If it's in sequence with numbered sentences,
that's
that
right.
That becomes an insurmountable task.
It could be impossible. And let's also just add to the mix, we're speaking about a one-armed man who typed these things out, according to witnesses, up to 60 words per minute.
Oh, my goodness.
With one hand in German, where you have all these capitalized nouns in sentences. I mean, it's a monumental task, a monumental task. And as you're saying, especially with typewritten things, you can't go back and start changing things around, especially when the documents have been disseminated with dates and numbers and sentences. And it's just, you know, there it is, folks, ironclad. And, you know, people rail against things, but they're illogical, and they never will sit down and deal with the actual facts of it.
Right. They'll just simply do what they did in the Middle Ages and say, you know, it's not of divine origin, it's
right.
not of the religion of science, and
right.
so therefore it cannot be. We have not sanctioned it by our holy universities. One of the reasons that this authentication or this validation was so important is that the Pleiarians apparently had a way of not only clarifying history and maybe our present state, but they also had a way of writing down predictions and prophecies.
Right.
First of all, what's the difference between a prediction and a prophecy?
Well, according to the way they tell it, prophecy means the likely outcome of events based, again, on the law of cause and effect, unless human beings, with their thinking and their actions, change them to a positive direction. In
like time. A warning.
Yes. So it's a these are warnings.
Mm-hmm.
And even the prophecies have very specific warnings about events or situations that will occur if changes aren't made. A prediction is an event, let's just say, that is going to occur with 100% certainty, which is unalterable, usually of a cosmic or natural nature outside of the control of human beings. But it can also refer to a prophecy that has gone past the point of no return.
Right. Right. Like you had a chance to correct things and you didn't do it, and so now the prediction is that these things
yes.
are going to occur.
Yes, and then they will occur.
And so getting back to my question, the validation or this authentication process of mm-hmm. recording the interaction between the Pleiarians and Billy Meyer in this fashion was important because a lot of these contacts would involve these prophetic or predicting events.
That's correct. And for the most part, they were given in the conversational context, where they're telling him things, and then they'd say something about, and, you know, on the such and such day of, you know, for February in a year and a half from now, whatever, this event is going to occur over here, and blah, 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 blah. Other times, they will give him, such as with the Enoch or Henoch prophecies or the prophecies of Elijah, Jeremiah, whatever, that are coming out, they will give him the prophetic information as they claim it has been in their keeping for a long, long time. So they will say, this is, you know, this is the prophecy of such and such, and here it is, and they'll dictate it to him. But the other things that occur interspersed throughout all the contact reports or contact notes are very often given in a conversational context.
Well, there are several classes of information here, and some of it is just totally fascinating to me.
Yeah.
For instance, apparently Billy Meyer was given a special review of the planet Venus.
Yes.
And, of course, we had not sent a probe to Venus prior to that time, nor did we have any really special knowledge about the more morphology of Venus, that is to say, anything more than the colors that we could see with a telescope. But we really hadn't applied what we consider advanced technology to Venus to get any information. And yet he was given special knowledge about this planet. And I think I got that he was actually taken there in the Pleiaren spacecraft, or maybe he was just told.
No, he was taken there.
Wow.
Right.
Now, that's fascinating. Do you have any more information about this trip than what I read?
Well, Meyer had claims that he's been taken and shown virtually every planet in the solar system. As far back as 1958, when he was writing his earliest, prophetic, predictive information, he foretold, and maybe he was also, passing on information from Sloth or anybody, he foretold two planets beyond Jupiter. Now, this is, we think about the Venus information. He was given very specific information that pertained to, was the coloration, the terrain, the wind speeds, the composition of the gases in the atmosphere, the thickness of the cloud banks, the nature of the magnetic field on Venus. And he was taken and shown it pretty up close. He was able to, observe all this firsthand. And the probes that both the Russian, or at that time maybe Soviet, and the U.S. Finally launched validated that information, as did a terrain map that was being done at the United States Geological Survey.
Uh-huh.
So, and that map was being done years later, and it was regarded as amazing by the lead investigator that Meyer was publishing this information.
And they just wouldn't take him for face value. The reason I know these things, Mr. Space Administrator, is I was there.
Exactly.
I was in a spacecraft, and I was taken there, and I was shown samples of it. I know what the planet's made of. I know what the wind speeds are and the magnetic fields.
Right.
And they wouldn't take that at face value.
No. I mean, I came upon Meyer's information that he published in advance on not only the rings of Jupiter, but the nature of two of the moons, Europa and Io. And he described Io as being the most volcanically active body in the solar system. And he was very specific about things. Well, I managed to contact a Dr. Joseph Baverka, the chairman of the astronomy department at Cornell University, shared the information with him, and he gave me one quote before he wouldn't talk to me anymore. And he kind of ran away from this when he realized this was coming from a guy, a UFO contact, because he said that Meyer's information, he said, well, as far as all he could say was, if he said that 3 to 6 months before, all I can say is he's right, meaning about Io and the conditions there. Well, we know he said it before the probe got there, and the lead military investigator had it before they even announced the findings on the moon Io. So this boggles the mind of a lot of people who feel, that because they're professors or scientists or whatever, they're privy to the, latest and greatest information, and they are the experts, and don't tell me that some little Swiss farmer is scooping me at all this stuff.
Yeah, we call it the religion of science.
Yes.
Yeah, you haven't had the holy deionized water sprinkled on it. It doesn't exist.
That's right. It doesn't exist. We're the experts. If it happened, we'd know about it. So
that's right. That's right. If it could be known, we would know it.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the favorite things that I hear. Well, again, the reason that all of this very factual, real world information was laid down over many decades is to lay a foundation for a relationship between an alien people, namely the Pleiarens. And by the way, how many are there? I mean, how many actually came here?
Of the Pleiaren people?
Right.
Well, the first person of the Pleiaren was the man Svat. And he was the elderly man that Meyer had the first contact with when he was a child.
Mm-hmm.
The second contact person was a woman named Asket, who was from a kind of a sister race in a parallel or adjoining universe to ours, and she's not a Pleiaren. Their race is called Timur people. Then you had Semyaze, her father Ptah, and a guy named Quetzal. These are at least the names they go by for the sakes of these contacts. And the contacts with those people began in 75. Since that time, Myers had contact with, I think nearly 40 other people. And,
my goodness.
Yeah, and primarily the Pleiaren, but other races as well. They are involved with a federation of other races that they, you know, are linked up with in the universe, and this is something that's been obviously in development for a long time. I guess all of them at this point are, to some degree or other, space-traveling races. They know of at least 41 million human races in the universe. Certainly, we're not talking in our neighborhood, but in the universe itself, at least 41 million human races with 343 different skin colors.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
And we think we have problems.
That's right. Well, we do, but it's not like that. And also, you know, variations in the numbers of digits and, you know, arms and what have you. There are variations in the theme. It's just that there are, you know, vast numbers of human or humanoid races, and they claim that there are other types of races as well, other types of beings, but that the human form is ubiquitous throughout the universe.
Mm-hmm. Now, all of these must have either incredible lifespans or they have a way of traveling across vast distances of space without taking a long time.
Right. Well, the ones that I think it's this way, it's that most all of them have longer lifespans than we do. We're on the short end of things. Some of them may have lifespans in the mere, you know, several hundred years, some into the thousands and more years. And the more advanced races, which are probably also among the more long-lived, also have higher technology with more advanced, techniques for, transporting themselves, let's just say, across space and sometimes across time at ever, you know, faster speeds, although even at certain point, you're not even probably talking speed in the same way we think of travel.
Right, exactly. And, with all of these races coming as guests of the Pleiarens, and certainly they're not the only spacecraft that have come to Earth, there must be some sharing of technology from advanced races to our races. I've had other guests on this program, not the least of which is, of course, Dr. Stephen Greer, who is, as you know, headed up the Disclosure Project, which is an effort to get the government to release everything that it knows about alien technology. I see that happening in the near future. And I say that with my tongue in cheek. But this advanced technology probably allows them to travel either across the galaxy, across the universe, or between universes as easily as we cross the street. But not to say they don't have their accidents, because, we have some evidence on this planet that not everything goes perfectly, even with high technology, and sometimes you lose control and crash. But there also is some evidence, at least maybe not evidence, but there's a feeling that governments are largely threatened for one cause or another, one reason or another, by alien races and alien visitation. So would you think that maybe one of the reasons that Billy Myers had so many attempts on his life and maybe debunkers out there is because they perceive the Pleiaren input as a threat?
Yeah, basically, you can encapsulate it kind of simple and understandable, but even predictable way. The powers that be in any structure don't willingly, gladly give up their power and or their, perceived power. And they also can perceive great threat to their power from situations that are outside of their control.
Mm.
So if indeed there are beings that can travel, let's just say in space, that are not relying on our fuel, our economy, our beliefs, our anything, and can operate
fully outside of that, out of the control of any terrestrial forces, that information must be contained in order for the power structures to not lose control and for their presumption that humanity would go nuts and, you know, there'd be widespread panic. This, one of the articles linked on my website, again, speaks about the, you know, the cover-up as originating in 1915, when the first UFOs were seen over the battlefields of Europe, and, you know, the Russians and early American presidents, even at first, it was perceived that these were of terrestrial origin, and the other people were thinking it was probably some, you know, secret weapons we had. But it was soon realized that these objects were not of terrestrial origin. And all the parties with their vested interests decided to not allow that information easily to get out to the public. And even though there are different entities at war with each other and, you know, in hostilities, they did not, decide to spring this truth on humanity, so to retain their own power.
I'm trying to visualize that the ground commanders are looking up at balls of wood and fabric airplanes flying around at about 80 miles an hour with no oxygen or anything, and then here comes a metallic object flying faster than the speed of sound. At what point did they realize, hey, this isn't from around here? And by the way, did anybody get a picture of that? But what the visitor coming and seeing World War One battlefields with gas and you know, launching projectiles at each other and literally hand-to-hand combat, what a terrible and primitive race they must have thought we were at that moment.
Well, I think it's also fair to say that it wasn't the first they'd seen of us
in our means.
It was just like, because this is a long-term project, let's say with the Meyer case, and the ETs in that race have long known what, you know, kind of a challenge there was in dealing with this Earth and attempting in one shape or form to assist and to, without interfering, without screwing things up more. So it probably didn't make them too happy, and it wasn't easy to take, but it wasn't as much of a shock as it must have been.
Well, assuming that they had been visiting this planet for millions of years,
right,
one race or another, there have been other advanced races, you know, very glorious and in their scope and their knowledge of math and science and technology, but they ended up on the same path. They still ended up, you know, destroying each other or being destroyed by some cataclysm. So maybe they were pretty familiar with it, but the fact that we see is so obvious to us that, yes, we have been visited. Yes, we are being visited. We have been given very valuable, priceless information to help us avoid a critical point of I'm going to call it juxtaposition, where we either are going to make it as a race or we're not. And yet this information is not received as well as one might hope. And, of course, hopefully this radio program will help get the word out and help people, go to the website and become more educated. And you can go to www.theyfly.com. And our guest is Michael Horn tonight, a very, very well-known authority on the Billy Meyer contacts. And if you're not familiar with the Billy Meyer contacts, you need to get familiar with them. One of the things that we want to do tonight is to go from here forward and try to discuss the importance of why. Well, we've already established that all the foundation was laid for the validity and authenticity of the existence of the Pleiarians, not just thoughts and ideas, but there was also physical evidence beside the photographs. There was a metallic sample, was there not, given to Billy Meyer?
Right, because we didn't cover that before when you raised it. There were a number of small pieces of metal alloys
that Meyer received from the Playiron, and that he turned over to the investigative team, who in turn turned it over for analysis to Marcel Vogel, who was a scientist at the time with IBM. And Vogel analyzed the metals. He turned on his scanning electron microscope, and he put on the video camera, and for about 45 to 60 minutes went through what he was seeing there. Basically, what he concluded was, with any technology that was available to him, he could not duplicate these metals. And he explained the reasons, the fact that all the elements in the periodic table were present in the samples, each a very discrete relationship to each other, but not, you know, mushed together as if they had been just simply done up in a furnace. But he concluded that this technology that had created these little alloy pieces had to be something like cold fusion or done in a vacuum in outer space. And he says, you know, we don't have that. We can't make this. The laser cuttings here are way too fine. Not only that, as I further examine the structure of these metals under the microscope, I can see that not only is metal, but there's crystalline structures in here. It's all very precise and clearly intelligently manufactured. It's not some anomaly of nature. And we shouldn't put this off to anybody's imagination. This is, you know, really quite remarkable. So we have the metal samples. We have sound recordings made by Meyer and his wife on four separate occasions on cassette machines that were analyzed at three different sound studios. They were unable to, none of them could determine what the source of the sound was. They only knew it was a rotating device that was going up and down in the, you know, the range.
And when were these recordings made?
About 1979, 1980, somewhere back in there. And the Naval Undersea Labs in Connecticut, they have the largest sound bank in the world. They could identify three airplane engines that they could detect in the sounds, but they could not identify the sounds that were the source that was creating the sounds in the Meyer recordings. And they also, you know, said that there were like something like 24 audible frequencies, and there were eight frequencies that were in the inaudible range that only showed up on spectrum analyzer and oscilloscopes. And hey, by golly, this is, you know, pretty tricky stuff here. So they seemed to be rather impressed, as were a couple other sound engineers in Hollywood who also analyzed the sounds and came up with similar conclusions. They couldn't duplicate them. They said it would take a bank of synthesizers to do it if they could. And so you've got this type of stuff. You've got plenty of physical evidence. You've got the fact that it all remains still irreproducible. Nobody, but nobody, has duplicated any of it. And this, despite the fact that all the skeptics had made so much noise about it and claiming they could. Just recently, there was a skeptic back somewhere on the East Coast, a guy named Jeff Ritzman, who claimed that, you know, one of Meyer's rather stunning series of photos, well, it was just a hoax, and he was going to prove it, and he was going to put up his photos on the Internet, and he was going to duplicate a video that Meyer shot. Well, you know, months have gone by. There's nothing there. And
well, that's actually a good scientific method. We always try to set out to prove something wrong, and then when we cannot do it, then we're pretty much left with the fact that it is real.
That's right.
One of my listeners has asked me a question. What was the nature of the metal sample? Was it a block or a shard or a plate?
They were small. They were small, like little squiggly pieces. They're shown in some of the photo books. You see photographs of them. And even though, you know, people have said, well, it's, you know, we've heard that all of them disappeared, so you can't prove that they were real. Well, a couple things. Number one, they were examined by a scientist who the last thing he needed was to put his name on a UFO case, and if it wasn't real, he sure wasn't going to do it. The other thing is that, you know, they still have some of these samples. They're not rushing to resubmit them for analysis for simple reasons. It's just like you put things into the chain of command, especially when so many people have a vested interest to destroy the case and, you know, manipulate things. It's less appealing to be involved with all the debunkers and what have you. But they were photographed, and you can see them in the book Through Space and Time. I think
Well, I don't know much about metallurgy, but I do know quite a bit about scanning electron microscopes.
Okay.
And I have looked at, well, more samples than I want to claim, but one of the things that I find really strange about SEM work is, of course, you have some observation effect. You are bombarding the thing with electrons.
Right.
But you would be surprised at how rough metal appears, even if it looks polished to us. Mm-hmm. It often looks like cornflakes. It's just amorphous, the way that metal, even alloys, and the reason we put alloys into metal is to share characteristics, whether they be heat transfer, flexibility, or mm-hmm. resiliency, or hardness, like tungsten carbide. Mm-hmm. But we have a tendency, when we put metal together, we just melt it together.
Right.
We put it at high temperature, and then we put in the alloys, and we try to make it as homogeneous as we can. We're not really good at laminating metals. We can gasify metals and coat them on one another to create coatings or special surfaces. But from what I understand, the way that these metals were put together was almost as if it was done on a molecular level with some kind of replicator or builder. Mm-hmm. They were actually physically put together. The metals maintain their integrity as pieces of metal, but they were fused together in a pattern that could only be seen under several thousand magnification that's capable or that's enabled with a scanning electron microscope.
Right.
And currently, other than nanotechnology, and we don't really have a way to put metals together, we can do certain elements we can put together like sapphire, but we cannot put metals together in that fashion. And by the way, nanotechnology really did not become functional until Dr. Kim Drexler made it so, but that was way after Billy Meyer presented his samples.
Yeah, there aren't too many Swiss farmers that can put together metal samples.
Well, there was a 14-year-old boy that put a scanning tunneling microscope together with rubber bands and some old electronic equipment, and it did function
as a
science project.
Right.
But that also was well after Billy
right.
Meyer got
well,
there.
Well, like when Marcel Vogel was examining the metal sample, he says, I found thulium in here, and he says, that's a very rare element. It's highly expensive. It's more expensive than platinum. And it was one of the elements that all were nicely sitting in there in their little discreet, manner. As you say, it hadn't all been melted together as if in a furnace. And we're too quick oftentimes to want to write things off as some kind of a hoax without thinking through it. And even when you get somebody who goes ahead and puts on the microscope and analyzes the thing and you're seeing it and there's always some objection because people really think, for some strange reason, that unless they, whoever they are, have seen something firsthand or they've been the ones to test it, even though they're not qualified to do it, it isn't real and it doesn't exist, which basically means that 99.9% of all of human history and experience isn't real because you or I haven't experienced it.
Exactly right. Who says they sailed iron ships in the Civil War? I never saw it.
That's right.
You're exactly right. In fact, last week conducted just man on the street interviews, just asking people a series of questions like, do you believe in UFOs?
Mm-hmm.
You'd be surprised the answers that I got.
Really?
Flat out no to, well, I've never seen one, and unless I see one, I'm not going to believe. Or I'd really like to believe that they're real, but no one, not one of them, I interviewed over 100 people,
wow.
Not one of them would say, absolutely, they exist, and whether I've seen them or not, I think they exist. Mm. It was amazing that this was a pretty homogenous man-on-the-street interview, not in any particular discrimination.
Well, these may have been homogenous people, but I guess they feel that unless it goes past your eyes...
yeah. And then they would say, what was that?
Right.
Wait, let me see that again.
So then it'd be homogenized and pasteurized.
Well, the point that we've reached in this interview, and this is probably the point at which we're going to redirect the psyche of the world, the contact between the Pleiarians and Billy Meyer, although completely fascinating about UFOs, about alien races, about predictions and prophecies, there are certain directions that were given to Billy Meier that were written down and really change, or should I say alter, the perspective of the human being to the creator or creation. Mm-hmm. And that's what I want to get into now. What, I guess we're going to just open a can of worms and say, what is the creation or the creator?
Right. Well, we are going to open a can of worms.
Okay, I'm
so
ready.
We might as well. I've got an electric opener here in case it doesn't go fast enough. What we've got here is Meier at a certain point turning to them and asking them the obvious question. Hey, you guys are from outer space. What do you know about God? Do you have God in your world? And
exactly.
All that. And they said, well, we don't use that term because we know what it means. And he says, well, now what are you talking about? What does it supposedly mean? And they said, well, all right, let's explain it to you this way. The term God is a term that's derived from some ancient, you know, languages and what have you. And it really came from a word that means king of wisdom or someone who is highly evolved in knowledge and wisdom, meaning a human being, always a human being, that is at a high level of development, technologically and spiritually. And these are the beings, these are the people that in our language, they said, in the Pleiaran or the Lyran language, the term is Ishwish for a man and Ishrish for a female. Somehow it gets moved down the chain through various languages and starts to come out Got or God. And they're saying that in every case, without exception, and the, or I should say the only exception being when it's strictly a contrivance of a, of, let's say, a very primitive race where they're making, you know, gods up to explain things. Otherwise, you're always talking about extraterrestrial human beings who were here long ago representing themselves as the creators or creator, the God, the Lord, whatever,
mm-hmm.
of all that exists, of all life. In many cases, they said, these were our own forefathers who set things in motion, namely many of the religions that you have to this day that are misleading people because they are alterations and dilutions and distortions of the truth. And they said, the term that we use when we are referring to the great force, the great all-pervading, all-creative, all-sustaining force that is life itself is the creation.
Mm-hmm.
And the creation, they state, is this universe itself, that we are living not in the first creation or the first universe ever to exist, but in one of countless billions of already existing universes or creations that go back, in terms of what we would consider time, enormously, enormously, you know, distant time. You know, take a wall and write 9 and then start adding 9s after it, you know, and commas after every third one to try and figure out how many years we're talking about. We can't really conceive of the actual nature of existence of, you know, the original creation and time and what have you. But they're saying the creation is this force. It is the source of all life. It's what you really mean when you're trying to speak about God or spirit or what have you. And it gives of itself a very, like you might say, holographic piece of itself to every human life form in the universe as the human spirit.
Mm-hmm.
So this holograph of the creation is the part of us that is destined to evolve over countless millions of lifetimes back into the creation to contribute to its evolution, its knowledge, its growth, etc. And this is, to put it in the most simple or simplistic terms, I'm, you know, it's like I can only basically describe my own understanding, let's say, limited understanding of what the creation is, because this is the lifelong pursuit of all human beings, they claim, is to learn, to know, to contemplate upon, to recognize, to dwell upon the creation. And if we were wise enough to be able to put our focus solely on the creation and see it in all things, then it, we would accelerate our spiritual growth and development.
So at this time, on this planet, in this year, we have spirits of all different ages, all different numbers of incarnations and experience going through a mortal experience at the same time.
Right. The thing is, as I understand it, we're going to have primarily, let's say, the greater number of spirits that are incarnating on the planet are going to be within a general sense of the same age and evolutionary level, as opposed to being very wide and, you know, variations, disparate dimensions of experience. So there's also said to be 52 million or so spirits of extraterrestrial origin, humans of extraterrestrial origin, who are in the incarnational cycle with Earth. Not all incarnate at this time,
right?
But, you know, part of it. So it's kind of like there's really only one place anyway, you know, that's going on as far as we're concerned, and that's, you know, this universe, and we're all part of it. Then you have, you know, differentiation. It's kind of what makes the game interesting, as the spiritual energy has taken different, you know, manifestations, an almost infinite number of manifestations and densities and dimensions and what have you. So, you know, that's life kind of thing.
Well, I've spoken to more than one person that sometime in their life, either in a meditative state or during a terrible life-threatening event or just a moment of realization, they feel like they're not completely from here, that, and perhaps that they've existed a long, long time before this life, that somewhere, maybe not a total recall place, but somewhere in their soul, in their spirit, in their mind, in their imagination, they've got experience with life that they are trying to draw from. They're trying to reach back. Maybe it's other lifetimes. I have spoken to people who are very convinced that they existed in other lifetimes. And I don't mean millions of years ago. I mean just a few generations ago, maybe 20 years ago or 100 years ago, they recall, you know, being in medieval Europe or in Aboriginal Australia or in Roman times. They remember these things and they draw upon those pains, those joys, those loves, those disappointments that they had in that lifetime, and try maybe to go a higher level in this lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And I've interviewed enough people to feel like there's got to be some credibility to it, because some of these people are maybe 10 or 11 years old, and yet they speak with such wisdom and almost as though they're recalling something that's just beyond their physical memory, but you can tell that it has affected them. And so I have a tendency not to discount what Billy Meyer has written and what you have elaborated on, not just in this interview, but also in your DVD.
Mm.
And it points to a call to become self-responsible, to not blame society or government or circumstances or to ask for anything other than yourself to help yourself, nor to rule over or take what someone else has.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to go as far into this as we can get in what do we got, about an hour and 10 minutes left. Really want to talk about the spiritual growth of the human spirit. I'll try to avoid using the word soul because that's kind of what I was raised on. But
sure, I think we all heard that one.
The eternal intelligence that makes up the individual personality that grows with each iteration, whether it's male or female, or whether it's passive in this lifetime and maybe aggressive in another lifetime. So what is that spiritual growth, and what is I'm assuming with each lifetime we become better at it. I'll put it that way. Maybe we don't devolve so much, but go into that a little bit.
Well, to the best of my ability, I'm studying this too. And I think we have to recognize that, you know, for the most part, most of us here, even if we find our most evolved people on the planet, we're sort of at a certain level. Let's just put it euphemistically that way. Our knowledge really is limited. And we have information in the Meyer case, their cosmologies, the Pleiaren, about the different levels of spiritual and even technological growth that human beings are, manifesting at different evolutionary stages along this growth process, seven stages of growth in seven sets with seven subsets. But before I get off at some tangent that won't mean too much, let me try to give you my take on this, which is we are responsible, as we said before, for our thoughts. Well, I don't know if we said that.
Sometimes we have irresponsible thoughts.
Yes, well, we do. But see, the spirit itself, as I understand this, the human spirit itself is a perfect balance of positive and negative. We need to develop both parts of it for evolution and growth, and that means we need to make mistakes in order to learn. We don't need to keep making the same mistakes, and we don't need to make every mistake either. It means that we aren't to be blaming ourselves or others for making mistakes as such, but we are to take that experience of a mistake and learn and, you know, accumulate knowledge and wisdom. That's one way. Now, we don't learn solely through mistakes, clearly. But as we learn and as we accumulate knowledge and wisdom, we are expanding our spirit is becoming more aware. It is becoming more educated. We are not sinful or fallen beings from some high state. It's actually the contrary. The spirit comes in with all of the potential. It needs the education that it can only gain through material life inside a human being. I'm sorry?
I believe that very thing.
Well, see, I don't know. I mean, this is what's said. That's why I'm going to stay out of whether I believe it or if it's true or not. I'm kind of paraphrasing what I understand so far from this. Now, I don't disagree with it either, but I just want to be careful to say I don't know. Certainly, I don't know on the level of being able to make some big overriding statement that this is reality, folks.
Yeah, but saying the words "I know" mean a lot in humans' philosophy. So,
yeah,
it's difficult to say I know this to be true because.
Right, I don't want to do that because I think whenever you get into the realm of spiritual, you know, things, especially as it's so easily confused with religion, which it isn't meant to be, we have the things that are annoying about, let's say, certain religious thought or behavior is people tell you that they know this to be true. And my premise is that there isn't a religion on earth that can go any more comfortably and honestly and deeply than to state that their premise is what's in this book is true because this book says it's true.
Mm.
That's it. I mean, there is no proof. Or we wouldn't have belief systems, we'd have knowledge. And we're being encouraged to leave behind the age of knowledge for the age of, pardon me, the reverse, leave behind the age of beliefs for the age of knowledge.
And
so,
I believe that all true religions have that very premise, that one day you will leave belief behind and you will have knowledge.
Well, that is, anything that is founded in truth and that has that as an essential teaching, to me, would be true. Now, I don't personally, from what I know of religion, since I know that they all contain misinformation, that, you know, I'm glad that they do have a caveat in there for those that are awake. Hey, you know, you might as well, you know, find out what's true because it's only going to be the truth that will set you free. And the religions, only have partial truths. Or obviously there'd only be one religion going on Earth, but everybody, you know, has their quote-unquote belief systems. So we're back on that track. But to get off that track and to try to go back onto the track of the creation and how we evolve in knowledge and truth and wisdom, one of the ways, they say, is for us to observe nature. Not to become pantheists and run around gambling through the woods, worshiping the trees, but to observe nature and to see the working of the creation in all of nature. And nature is also biology and physics. I mean, we can't leave it out of that. Yes, the study of certain things can be science, but we see the workings of nature here.
Yes.
You know, so we have that. And then at the core of these teachings is reverence. Reverence for all life, reverence for the creation, reverence for all humans. It doesn't mean that we, you know, on the other hand, when people misunderstand things, well, does it mean that nobody's bad and you let people run all over you? No. It means that we hold reverence for life and we look to see the creation in all things, but we also are prudent. We protect ourselves. We don't allow ourselves to be victims, and neither are we perpetrators. We look to have that balance of progress without doing harm or as little as possible. And there's so many ways to contemplate this idea of the creation and the spirit and how to live without having a cult or a belief system, a guru, rabbi, priest, master, saint, ascended man, whatever, who's your intermediary. Because they're actually also saying that the original Lord's Prayer wasn't the Lord's Prayer. It was Emmanuel's Prayer. And it, I'm just paraphrasing because I don't have it in front of me. It was, you know, my spirit that dwells within me, thou art omnipotent, unfold, you know, in me your awareness. And, you know, it was an inside out job.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't the go to the outside and pray to a, you know, a deity or a universe that's already gotten it right. In other words, when we're directing our prayers outside of ourselves and trying to get something to be corrected by the divine force or the universal force, we're kind of in an illogical state because clearly the universe hasn't made any mistakes that I know of. Human beings may have.
Well, some people would say that chaos is mistakes in action, but it really isn't. Chaos is a very real and physics-oriented system.
Mm-hmm.
But that being said, although we're doing this inside-out thing, one of the things that we like to do I like to do as a human being is I like to help others. And I think my own personal knowledge that there are spirits on this planet and off this planet that have a great desire to help one another.
Sure.
And for wherever I have seen this in history, where you have a great helper or a great teacher who comes and says, listen, you know, these are things that are important in the universe and maybe not so important in this mortal life. Quit fighting over fish and bread and let me maybe show you a different point of focus.
Right.
History has shown us where society tends to take these individuals and raise them up, make them gods, make them leaders, make them priests or whatever. And that might be all well and good for that generation, but inevitably that priest or king or teacher or ruler has a real idiot for a son.
Yeah.
and then comes the dictatorship and the oppression and the war. And we're going through right now, and maybe every 2 years when we have congressional elections, we have people who don't want to lose power, and so they go through all kinds of machinations to keep their power instead of going home like they should.
Right. So
I see the interaction of self with self, like saying, okay, I am part of the creation, and the creation is in me, and so therefore I need to transcend my desire to take what my neighbor has and be more concerned with what I can do.
Mm-hmm.
But I also see the interaction of one spirit with another. Like, I love you. I want to be bonded with you mm-hmm. forever because I'm complete when I'm near you. So there's that relationship between one spirit and another. And if it's between two, then it can be between more. And so there are relationships between very developed spirits and underdeveloped spirits in a benevolent way. And am I off base here?
I don't know. It sounds good to me. I mean, I basically would agree with a lot of what you're saying because I think you're describing things accurately. We have the you know, the lower materialistic drives and at any cost that many people give into and perpetuate for power and position.
And then we put it in leadership positions.
Yeah. And then, you know, right.
I don't want to stir up anything political, but I think one of the most dangerous forces we have on Earth today, and I don't mean this as an American, I just mean it as an Earthling, is patriotism.
Mm.
To one creed or one nation or one ruler or constitution, that in exclusion of all else seems to be the basis of all conflict on this planet at this moment.
Well, you know, I've been looking at that because I kind of always have held this very idealistic thing of, you know, we're all one people. This is one world and we're all just human beings. And it's, when I was reading the Meyer material, and this is again where you just, when you think you've got this thing you can understand or agree and oh yeah, it all makes perfect sense. They also talk about the destructive force of illegal immigration. Well, let's look at that for a second, because that means that there are countries and states and differences and boundaries and borders. But let's, you know, try and explore that without losing it here. We are at a stage in human development where we still are separate in our developments, whether it's good, bad, or otherwise. We still are composed of so many separate countries and this, that, and the other thing. And what they were saying about the dangers of illegal immigration were that when one group of people seek to have what others have worked to create, but without doing the hard work in their own land of bringing themselves into a certain level of function and efficiency and economic balance and all the rest, but they simply want to pursue the economic advantage that they could get by going to another country which has accomplished that, then there's an inevitable imbalance that takes place and leading to strife, even wars and famines and persecutions and what have you, because the persons who come strictly for the economic advantage cannot contribute, or rarely do, at the same level necessary for the society that they're partaking of its benefits in order to keep it moving in an evolutionary way. Rather, they will drain its resources. They will inadvertently cause some of the fabric of that society to break down. It has no commentary on whether the people are good or nice or not. It's just to them, a fact of how this is going to function. So what they're saying is people have to, as long as you are in a world with all these different groups, you need to each bring yourself up to that standard that you value and make your own countries and lands functional and, you know, educate yourselves and balance your economics and all this. And in a time, you will have to become one world. If you're truly going to become people who will ever travel in space, and or if you have to defend yourselves against some hostiles that will come from somewhere out of the depths of space and find you and want to take your world, you'll have to be unified. And yes, of course, you are to become unified as people, but you also have to recognize where you're at right now. And that the danger, they say, is that there will be those persons who will try to, in effect, create worldwide dictatorship, as some people who speak about conspiracies as, you know, one world governments and what have you.
One world government, yes.
So Meyer, as far back as 1958, predicted that the EU would not only exist, but that the EU and the USA would ultimately be the two powers that would try to enslave the world through biochipping.
Well, nobody would have thought that on their own in 1958, that's for sure.
Right.
Let's take a very short break. Let me do a couple of commercials, take a musical interlude, let you get some water or whatever. Take about 3 or 4 minutes. And
4 minutes? Good. I'll take it because I need to get some water.
All right. Are you interested in stuff for your space? Well, I just bought a leather hand-tooled map for my office. It hangs on the wall. It's about 30 inches square, and it has beautiful wooden rods that hold its shape. It's 21st century Europe, hand-tooled into this leather. It looks awesome next to my Egyptian papyrus paintings. And you can get them by going to Novica and follow the link at X Squared Radio. In cooperation with National Geographic, you can find some of the best art and sculptures, and these are many of them replicas at very reasonable prices, by visiting Novica at X Squared Radio. Also, one of the things that in this modern age we run into all the time are empty inkjet cartridges. Have you bought any for your printer lately? Wow, I paid about $80 to replace the color and black cartridges at a national retail store that will remain unnamed. Well, no more. Now I do all my inkjet shopping at 123 Inkjets. I bought a color cartridge for less than $20 for my HP 960C, and I got free shipping, and I got a free chance at winning a free printer. And that goes on every day at 123 Inkjets. Forget about those high prices for inkjet cartridges and other printer supplies. So click on the 123 Inkjet sign at X Squared Radio and start saving money. And don't forget to check out their other printer supplies and even printers. 123 Inkjets at X Squared Radio. Also wanted to mention, with only a few missions left, the space shuttle fleet will soon be decommissioned. I know it's hard to believe. I grew up with that. This spacecraft has carried the entire planet into the next millennia with dozens of satellites, probes, hundreds and hundreds of experiments. It has inspired us all. I never got to go to Florida and watch a launch. I always wanted to. I doubt that I will make it down there for any of the next few launches. I'm just too busy with other things, just like you are. That's why I like to shop at the space store. They have the neatest stuff. I have a model of the space shuttle orbiter that's over 25 inches tall in my library. Visitors always stop and comment how fantastic the detail is. The cargo doors open. This thing is really, really well done. I want to keep the memory of this great program alive because it represents the best efforts of the human race. And you can too by clicking the Space Store sign at X Squared Radio. They have great stuff for kids of all sizes, even ones big as me. Got a birthday or a holiday coming up? Visit the Space Store at X Squared Radio. You just might inspire the next generation of space explorers. And we will take a short 45-second musical break, and we'll be back with more of Michael Horn. This is Brooks Agnew at X Squared Radio. Get into what I call the Pleiaren perspective. That's what I kind of got out of this CD. We kind of scratched the surface a little bit, but we're talking about the individual spirit, and we started to get into where we're talking about trying to live as earthlings instead of different nations. And there were some warnings. I don't know if they're predictions or prophecies. I couldn't make it out, but some clarifying statements about the further development of mankind on the Earth. I think we've pretty carefully laid down that the Pleiarens and their interaction with Billy Meyer are credible. the things that they said came to pass, some on a very short term, like less than a few months, others years and years and decades in advance, laid out and happened just as they said it would. So the credibility is there. The authenticity is irrefutable. Both the photographical proof, the text proof, the ideas that were laid out, all of that is irrefutable. So now that we've got this basis of trust laid, and Michael and I are talking about maybe going a little bit into the future, maybe just a little bit past your imagination, but that's okay. We don't want you to hang up. We don't want you to give up on us. We want you to have an open mind, because what we're about to lay out before you may shake the church you grew up in, but that's all right. We're not trying to take your faith apart. We just want to open your mind and maybe let you see a little bit past what you've been taught before. We talked about cause and effect. We talked about the human spirit as a holographic, what did you say, a spark of creation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it dwells in each of us?
Yes, every
and
human being.
See, we talked about a balance between the soul and the psyche, or the soul is the psyche located in the solar plexus. I'm taking notes while we're talking. It's okay. And the fact that we have indeed individual spirits have developed over eons of time. We just can't even describe it in years, can we?
No.
It's well beyond that. And that's not to say that we're going to go on forever and ever having mortal experiences one after another until we get it right. It's not to say that every single one of us on this planet are in exactly the same level of development, because I think there's a gamut, a range of soul, of spirits on this earth, would you say?
Well, yes, there's certainly a range of experience, development, knowledge, all of those things. And yet, if I'm understanding this correctly myself, we fall with us in a certain range or bandwidth, you might almost say, of experience, knowledge,
right,
ability. So the Pleiarians state that in this seven part system of evolution, that for the most part, Earth, humans, us, we are somewhere in the twos, in the different levels of development within the range of the overall system number two, or developmental level number two. They claim that they're somewhere for the most part in the fives, and that there are beings that are above them in the sixes, moving towards the seventh, you know, level, where merging with creation, you know,
where the need to be totally physical, you've transcended that.
Yes, you're on your way into non-material form. So they do not claim to be the most advanced beings in the universe. They don't claim to, again, as their forefathers did, to be God or gods. Simply more advanced than we are, and you know, able to hopefully offer us something in a somewhat oblique manner, that if we look and refer to what you were just speaking about, this record of, let's say, about 55 years of solid, credible, prophetically accurate, scientific, and world event-related information, we can say, you know, fairly, this is the largest body of virtually error-free, accurate information, prophetically accurate information on top of that, that's ever been available to humankind. With that being said, what is the message of that? And to me, the message is, okay, we've taken a long time to painstakingly establish our credibility, as you mentioned before, with the you know, the purpose being that hopefully humanity will take a look now at what we are telling you about where we perceive you to be, where we perceive you to be going, some of the ways in which life works you might want to take advantage of and focus on. And basically, if I was to put it into any kind of, you know, one term, I'd say we have the opportunity, excuse me, to rewrite our future history, our that which is foretold, should we not be wise enough to change.
Well, one of the things that I see, and I'm just an observer here, an earth explorer, is I see people, whole peoples, going through life asleep. And then there are others that are awake, and it's like they're moving through the pylons of other cars on the freeway, so to speak. How do we differentiate that? I mean, those of us that are awake, we look up at the stars and we see something completely different than someone who's asleep on this world.
Well,
they live from paycheck to paycheck and they could care less about this.
Right. I think one of the things that it's helpful to do while we're having that awareness and realization is to also just take it a step farther and say, if I can conceive now that I'm awake to this and that I perceive those who are asleep, you know, a lot of those who are asleep to what I perceive, I must also logically and honestly recognize that on some levels I am asleep to things that I don't even know I'm asleep.
Yes, exactly right.
Right? So while I look around and I see, quote-unquote, sleepy humanity here, I have to have a certain compassion for my others, my other friends here. I have to also note that there are always going to be those right here in the same world that are even more awake and alert and knowledgeable than I am. I may or may not know who they are. And then there are those who are above us, such as these Pleiaran people, in terms of their evolution on all levels, and who wisely stay outside of our immediate radar so that we can't become overly attached and focused on them, but rather hopefully get back to the business at hand, which is to see what it is they're trying to tell us, that we might lift ourselves and awaken ourselves and others further.
I had a couple of notes come up. One, a question, where did humans come from? In other words, when this planet was ready for population,
right?
Where did we originate?
Well, what I understand here is this, that one of the, you know, creational laws in this universe is that when a planet should develop it along the lines of its own evolution sufficiently to be able to support various life forms, those life forms appear as part of the creational, you know, law, if you will, or purpose. And human beings are considered to be, and this isn't from any ego point, we're considered to be the higher life form. At least we have the higher potential. Mm-hmm. All other life forms have their own purpose as well. Doesn't mean they're lesser or bad things, but animals do not have the same evolutionary destiny or purpose as human beings do. So human beings appear on a planet when it's ready, and they appear in very, very primitive forms at first. So many human beings that are on this planet now have been evolving for a very long time on this planet, you know, over countless incarnations here. And also, there are human beings that are here whose, let's say, spirits originated in incarnations on other worlds and who came here and either were stranded here or whatever. But part of the law of reincarnation is you are reborn on the planet on which you die. You don't get to choose to float around the universe. I think I'll show up on Venus next lifetime, you know.
Okay. All right.
So, yeah. So what happens is, and of course, then that begs the question, well, wait a minute. How do you ever get to another planet or live on other planets? Well, when you become a space traveling race, you can then move to another, you know, world and explore it. Should you die on that world, you will incarnate or reincarnate on that world, providing several things, among which are that there is human life on that world, whether it came from, you know, other extraterrestrials to that planet, or if there are indigenous life forms, providing there are life forms there at the same evolutionary level mm-hmm. that you are at. Now, if you die on a planet and those life forms aren't there, I think the possibilities are that you will either remain in the unincarnated state in what is known as the beyond until the life forms, if they are to evolve, they're evolved to that level of, you know, development, or the spirits migrate, and this is an unconscious process, to the next closest habitable world where the evolutionary level of the human beings is at the same approximate level as those spirit forms which are attracted then to that new sphere for incarnation.
Sounds logical.
Yeah, it is. The logic is there. It's like if our planet, for instance, if a cataclysm happened here and our planet was destroyed itself, and meaning either we were hit by some incoming object that destroys the planet, or more likely by the objects running around on the planet already, meaning human beings who blow the place up, and that isn't a given. We don't have to do that. But if that should happen, all the spirit forms on this planet would have to be migrating to the next closest inhabitable world at this level of evolution. Hopefully, they've also gone a little beyond it, just enough to, you know, bring us up a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So there are, you know, there are in creation, from what I understand from the information, they're very specific laws. There's nothing willy-nilly here. You don't get to just float around and do your thing, but it all operates according to the quote-unquote laws of creation.
So if we think about that just for a moment, and we believe that we have been visited for hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years, that certainly there have been alien spirits die on this planet,
mm-hmm.
and have waited until, well, let's say the last 100 years, when technologically we were able to transfer enough knowledge into human brains to allow us to begin to evolve as a sentient race instead of hunters and gatherers, maybe now they're being incarnated.
Well, it's also possible to consider that those incarnations may have also taken place during times when, let's say, the Atlanteans existed here, or at the higher levels of some of the ancient civilizations, where it may have, and I'm saying may because I don't know this with certainty, but there may have been sufficient development present, because some of those ET races may also still have been here, so that reincarnations could have been taking place for spirits of extraterrestrial origin even a while ago. And then perhaps that also then diminished at a certain point when they so-called, when the higher level of evolution wasn't taking place here. I'm guessing.
Exactly right. Now, one of the things that I got off the DVD, which, by the way, if you just tuned in, is The Meyer Contacts, The Key to Our Future Survival. It's a DVD available at theyfly.com, which is a website maintained by Michael Horn or his associates. There is a mention of that we were genetically manipulated, or that some generations of humankind were genetically manipulated, and because of our aggressive nature, we were bred to have a short lifespan,
mm-hmm.
and that it is reversible through our own development, that as we become we don't lose our aggression completely, because certainly to survive in the universe, we're going to need some kind of desire to be self-preserving,
mm-hmm.
but not so aggressive that we desire to take what other people have, but we don't build for ourselves.
And that
we're nearing that apex, that point where we can actually begin to see the shift.
Yes, well, what's said in the context here is said that eons ago, 22 to 28 million years ago, in the Sirian star system, there was a bunch of goings on that affect us today.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, what we are told about that is that the Sirians were ETs whose own ancestors came from the star system of Lyra, or Lyra, however you want to call it, the Harp,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and that some of these ETs settled in the Sirian star system, and some moved on ultimately to go and become what we know as the Pleiaren people. Now, we know also that the Dogon tribe of Africa was speaking about the stars of Sirius A and B before our scientists knew they were there. It's kind of an interesting thing. If people go on, they can do some searching for the Dogon, and you'll find that little bit about them up. Kind of interesting. Now, In the Sirian star system, it said that the people who inhabited those stars, these were, of course, were people who were already space travelers and what have you, that they had done some genetic engineering on themselves to the degree that they had eliminated their aggression so far as even really diminishing their own fighting spirit and their ability to, you know, take care of themselves, recognizing the trouble when they started to become easy marks for aggressive extraterrestrial races. They decided that not only did they have to correct their own, you know, genetics again, but they had to be really swift, and they created a warrior race to protect them during this transition, to be willing and capable fighters on their behalf.
How about that?
So the story goes. It's kind of like, you know, long, long ago in a distant galaxy far, far away or whatever. Well, they also recognized, you know, the fact of life at this point, and they made two adjustments genetically to these peoples. And one was to limit their lifespan to 100 years or less so that these genetically altered peoples could not overthrow them, the creators. And two, they amped up the aggression, the propensity for violence and aggression, so that they would be willing and able, you know, warriors and able to carry out vigorously and enthusiastic whatever violence and defense was necessary. So when this purpose had been served at some point, and the Sirians had no longer a quote-unquote need for these people, there were those among the Sirians who decided that they would eliminate them. That means that they would simply exterminate all these people. Yeah, I mean, you know, they figured, hey, we don't need them anymore, and they're only going to be trouble. Well, obviously, there were those among the Sirians who said, you know, that's not a real spiritual way to go. We can't do that. So there were these two factions that were in disagreement and at odds with each other. And at some point, kind of surreptitiously, one faction that was more benevolently inclined took a large number of these people in large spaceships and fled from the Sirian star system on a long journey until they found some habitable planets in a kind of remote little solar system at an outpost end of a spiral arm of the Milky Way somewhere, i.e. Earth, Mars, and a third planet, alternately called Phaeton, Maldek, Melona, depending on
who you talk to. Marduk, I've heard it called.
Yeah, so all these different names. Now, the Sirians that took these people were basically, at least initially, these were benevolently intended, you know, Sirians who wanted to protect these people and saw it as a spiritual crime. Not all of them apparently remained benevolent. Some got megalomaniacal because they were now effectively the gods of these peoples. The three planets were inhabited. On the third planet, let's just call it Melona for right now, the people got very good at developing weaponry and still having these aggressive tendencies, got into wars with each other. One faction at some point was detonating nuclear bombs and directing the seawaters into magma chambers of volcanoes, and the planet blew up. Everybody was killed, and the remnants of the planet are the asteroid belt, we're told. On Mars, you know, so you get these stories, they're pretty interesting. Mars, we're also told, suffered from a great cosmic catastrophe when what is called the Destroyer Comet made one of its periodic rounds through the solar system. I don't know if it's 500,000 years ago or what, but some significant time ago, it was said to have come through, caused a great upheaval, and basically wiped out all the people that were living on Mars, with some exceptions that were able to flee. And so the only planet left, you know, kind of functional and habitable was Earth. Now, those spirits that would have died on Melona and Mars, those humans, what would be the closest planet for them to begin to inhabit? Well, it would be Earth.
Earth.
Yeah, so they would be in the incarnational cycle here, more than likely. And we've got this deal then where we've got all these people who have, you know, their various gods there, and overlords are lording it over them and losing all record of their true origins. And this is a huge point that's raised in the Meyer material, that
and not even that this is the first time it's happened for anybody, but that these types of things, the people tend to lose their true histories. And so when various gods or rulers come into play and then represent themselves as the creators of the universe or whatever, you get new histories written and you get religions. And so it's almost like you can't tell the players without a scorecard down here. I mean, if you think about how complex this is in this cosmology, it's a wonder that, you know, we're still at it here. But so what they're saying is that the humans of Earth now, without exception, have all inherited the genetic manipulations of short lifespan and excess aggression. They also state that the most recent arrivals racially on the planet are the Asian races, who got here about 26,000 years ago. There are documents that are called the Takayuki documents in Japan that are like ancient maps and documents, even showing atomic explosions thousands of years ago in the areas of Japan. Now, the Pleiaren have also told Meyer that we've had these, you know, nuclear wars before. We have Sodom and Gomorrah. Those were nuclear events. The Gobi Desert is connected to destruction of Lemuria when Atlantis and Lemuria were warring. We have,
that goes back 25,000 years.
Or yes. And then you've got Death Valley and Fire Valley here in the Southwest, which they say is the result of nuclear conflagration about 50,000 years ago. So we barely know anything about our true history if what they're saying is true. And as I said before, we still have to put all this under the banner of speculative because we can't. We can't do better than that. Now, scientific discovery.
Be that as it may, it's a pretty credible banner because they have laid down this groundwork of all this credible evidence, and they have been very patient over many decades. They haven't just come in, told their story, and left.
Right.
And so we, as you say in the DVD, we really have to ask the question, is this true?
Right.
And once you realize that at least some of it is true, the rest of it may be open for discovery, then what do I do about it? And I guess that's kind of where we're at the point right now. If you've realized that it's true, do I go back to my job on Monday and don't pay any attention about the development of the race? In other words, is what I think and what I do as an individual, is it important to the future of the human race?
Yes. We come back to something we were even touching on before when we were speaking about self-responsibility and what's the core of this thing all about. Because let me digress just a little without really digressing. It said, and I've spoken to Meyer about this, and some of it's in the contact report, the Pleiaren themselves, you know, from what we know here, they are a highly advanced race technologically. Their agriculture, they've taken genetic engineering to enormous heights. And yes, they've acknowledged that genetic engineering holds dangers, but everything does. They've said we have to understand that science, it's a neutral thing. How we use it will determine, you know, the result, and we will make mistakes. Remember that. It's part of a given. So we have to not just blanketly object to anything that we think is, you know, must be evil, but rather find a way to work things out in a positive way. So what we do, how is it important to us once we've, let's say, accepted that this Meyer case appears to be a real deal, and we've got all this information, there's a ton we can't prove, but we do see this base of credibility, it leads us to consider that some beings have a motive that isn't aggressive towards us or hostile. They certainly could have long ago, when we were even less technologically developed, acted against us. Had that been their goal? Okay, so by thinking and reasoning our way through it, we go, all right, they're trying to help us in their own little way. Well, what is it here? What are we supposed to do, like you just said? Well, we come back to this idea that we are responsible for every thought we think and every action we take along the lines of self-responsibility. By learning and disciplining ourselves to consciously monitor all of our thoughts, that means we have to become aware of them. We start becoming consciously familiar
with what it is we believe, what we are perpetuating consciously or otherwise. And then as we start to notice that, we then move to the next level where we can start exercising some choice. So if we are monitoring our thoughts, and we're kind of amazed listening to the stuff that rattles through our brains on a daily basis, what the heck am I doing in there? And then we start to say to ourselves, well, wait a minute, no, I keep having that same thought, and I also seem to act on that all the time. I don't prefer that. That's not bringing me the result that I want. Well, there's, what am I going to do about it? Well, then we have the next step. We have to learn, how do we choose? What do we do to create a positive alternative? So everything here is throwing us back in on ourselves at these very discreet and annoyingly almost minuscule levels of responsibility. And people are going to say, well, how is that going to change the world? You know, look at the terrible things going on out there and blah, blah, blah. Well, the macrocosm is the reflection of the microcosm. The mess we're in didn't occur overnight. It occurred because, yes, we've been asleep at the wheel. We've let others run the show for us. We're all responsible. It doesn't mean we have to flagellate ourselves. It means more like, hey, let's get on with the game here and clean the mess up. So they're saying, okay, you still have to now go back to square one. Become aware of your thinking. Choose if you're going to perpetuate certain thoughts, or if you're going to decide that once you recognize that your thinking and your situation is in a way that isn't preferable for you, that you don't prefer, that you're going to create a positive, preferable thought, monitor so that you create more positive feelings, that your expressions and behaviors and actions are an outgrowth of that. It's small stuff. For most of us, it's going to be very small stuff, but we're weaving a fabric. And we, meaning your show is heard all over the world by virtue of being on the internet. And when people, any and everywhere, start to get this idea that it's really a mundane, non-glamorous bit of work that can nonetheless be extremely joyful, because we come to know ourselves, we come to see creation in all things, including in ourselves, we start to attract other people of like mind. We start to become little lights, just glowing at an ever-increasing, slowly increasing brightness. And we notice each other. We don't have to all think alike. We don't have to form the same beliefs. But then we're discovering, also in this process, what the true and eternal principles of human development are in this creation. And instead of dealing with things politically, which means instead of trying to seek advantage and agreeing to do something if we get what we want from it, we seek to do something for the sake of knowing what's right. There's a difference here. And so in doing that, we also now start to transcend these selfish kind of things that are based on whether we like things or not, but rather on what we prefer based on truth and universal law. And, you know, these are a lot of words that are coming out here, but I'm just trying to, in doing all this blah, blah about it, to say the real work is the slow, individual, conscious, dedicated, day-to-day kind of thinking and acting that we all, without exception, have to partake of. And so, as perhaps a near final thought on that, the Pleiaren themselves no longer have political systems. They have elevated their most spiritually developed and wise people to the positions of leadership. These people have the same duties and responsibilities as anyone else on the planet. They're not celebrities, and they don't have preferential treatment. They work as everybody else works.
They work for their own support.
That's it. So basically, with all the jawing I'm doing here, it's really saying it's a step-by-step process that each one of us has to partake of.
Well, if I'm hearing you correctly, then the words, as a man thinketh, so is he.
There you go.
Extends to maybe as a race thinketh, so is it.
Sure.
So even though on an average level we're not geneticists and we're not space travelers or even government officials, we're just plain old individuals. We work in a factory site. We're sitting in our cubicle, working in our computer, processing some spreadsheet or some human resource document, and we're listening to this program. And we realize that, yeah, I think I can gain control over my own thoughts. I think I can make conscious choices to not be mean to someone. And we have a core belief on this program, and that is that everything we do will eventually affect the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And we try to do that on purpose.
Yeah.
So the fact that some of us on a very beginning scale are going to have to get a hold of animalistic thoughts that come across our mind all the time, whether they're the lust of the eye or the pride of life or the lust of the flesh, we have to transcend that. We have to find the beauty and the goodness and the value in other people. We have to recognize that and bring that out. Like you said, be a light, I guess, to one another. And if you've heard this program, then maybe you've got a head start on that, but you can affect other people in your office complex, in your building, in the convenience store where you buy your coffee in the morning coming into work. You can affect all of these people. And like Michael is saying, sort of like, like bees in a hive, we collectively create a temperature, create an energy
mm-hmm.
with our own spirits that not only spreads to one another, but it also spreads to a society and hopefully to a planet. One of the things we talked about earlier was a revelation that the Pleiarians had made that illegal immigration was bad. And I thought of several individuals that I know that have come from Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked them, what makes life so different on one side of a river or the other side of a river? And they said, well, you know, when I'm in Monterey, I can work for a month and not have enough to buy a television. But I can work for one day in the United States and I can have enough to buy a television. And I said, well, all right, after you buy the TV, after you get all the stuff, then what do you do? And they said, well, I send money home, you know, to my family in Mexico. And I said, well, that's wonderful, but now they have a means of support that they have not worked for.
Mm-hmm.
And now you've created a system. You've created an income for a nation that is literally their number one cash revenue. And what you've done is you've hurt your country.
Yes.
Because now your country cannot make life good enough on the other side of the river so that you don't have to come over here. Or if you did come over here, we could go over there and it would be exactly the same mm-hmm. life on one side or the other of the river. And it should be that way. And it should be that way on either side of an ocean, either side of a border, until eventually the border just dissolves
mm-hmm.
and we become earthlings.
Yeah.
And then maybe we're ready for this level where we don't listen to sales talk and elect politicians based on how they look on TV or how they wear a suit or, my goodness, how even their voice sounds on the radio. We have ordinary people representing us. And
mm-hmm.
and further, like you were saying, they don't live off of what they vote themselves out of the national treasury,
right.
They work for their own support, just like intelligent races do all over the universe.
The Pleiarians, it's true leadership will no longer come from the top down. It comes now from the bottom up.
By I think example, that's a wonderful idea.
By example. So this isn't to say that, let's just say that we're waxing poetic here about these things, and not to diminish what we're talking about at all, but people sometimes think, well, that suddenly they think that they are the next, designated leader or something for a country, and they're going to, it isn't about that. It's about
service,
become inspired to understand how things work and serve. And in the service, then we learn, because really, is there any place that's better than any other? Only if we make it so. So we're in one universe, and there may be people that live on other planets or travel in spaceships, but there's that old corny saying, you know, wherever you go, there you are. So we bring our consciousness and our thoughts wherever we go, and extraterrestrials have come here in the past and screwed things up for us as easily as human beings who are of earthly origin. So like all the things you're saying, it's really we have to grasp what we're creating, and then you've got your cause and effect again. So, yeah.
So we are empowered to do something about it. We are empowered to change our direction and I guess you're saying that, you know, when we say, what do we do about it together, it means that we can change, like you said, the future history.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have to go down the same nuclear annihilation pathway that other civilizations have gone before us.
No, but we do have to recognize where we are. See, they have something that they call neutral positive thinking. They claim that both outright negative thinking and positive thinking lead to degeneration, to negativity.
Oh.
Why would positive thinking lead to degeneration? Because, if I'm understanding this correctly, if you are simply into positive thinking and you do not recognize when something is negative, what is the thing, you know, as it is, then you are kidding yourself. You're lying to yourself. And the result of lying is always going to be a compounding of the negative consequence of the lie. And they consider lying in any form to be illogical. They consider diplomacy to be a form of lying. If you start to see this whole thing, it's like you keep on cutting away at the beliefs and the structures that we ourselves have created that don't work for us. Positive thinking is only functional when we are in true neutral positive. We first recognize what is and or what we do or don't prefer. From that place, we can act and create the preferred thoughts, feelings, and actions. And then we can correct things, but we have to know where we're at first to do it.
I see. So we don't just sit around and say, everything is wonderful.
No, we don't just do affirmations. You know, it's like, I always thought it was funny that people who are very wealthy don't have affirmations on the refrigerator saying, I'm a wealthy, prosperous person. They already know that part. You know, people who are in good physical shape don't usually have to have an affirmation about it. So when we're having affirmations, generally, we haven't yet even fully recognized where we are. We want to gloss over it. We want to affirm something without getting the full dimension and take on where we are, maybe how we got there, and what we have to do to get to where we prefer, to what we'd want to affirm. So it's, you know, it's all work. It's all work.
Yes, I know it's work. And I do have to say, the very most important things are affixed to the refrigerator door. I'm positive of that. I know, because every day I go to the refrigerator and I see the things I'm supposed to be doing for the year. And amazingly enough, a lot of them get done.
Yep.
And if I post them any other place, I forget about them. But if they're on their refrigerator door, it's the most important space in the house.
I stick mine in my computer, so every day I wake up and I look and say, this is what I'm going to accomplish today, or I'll maybe move it to tomorrow if I don't. But if it keeps moving, I've got to take a look and see what's wrong.
Exactly
here.
Right. It's that little reminder every day. Well, now, there's something else that we can do, too. I was noticing on the DVD there is some exercises that the Pleiadians have suggested that we do in a synchronized way as a race.
Mm-hmm.
And they have, I think, 8 p.m. and 9 p.m. European Standard Time. What is that in relation to Eastern Standard?
Right. We're speaking now about what's called the Salome Peace Meditation.
Mm-hmm.
It is said that this meditation is actually done by about 3.2 billion extraterrestrial humans on our behalf, with an ever-growing number of Earth people who are finding out about it and deciding to participate.
That's a wonderful idea. I want to go over it in the next 9 minutes if I can.
Okay, well, let's just say, first of all, that the information is on my website at They Fly.
Right.
And that if we don't fully explain everything right here and now, people can email, they can look at the information, we'll try to refine whatever it needs to be so they can understand, participate. Basically, this is a meditation that takes only 20 minutes. It's done with an old, if you will, mantra that they claim is quite ancient, and that by the performance of this mantra by people in concert with each other all over the world and even apparently all off-world, that the negativity of the planet is somewhat dissipated and more of the positivity can emerge.
And does this not sound like a wonderful idea?
I like it. And I do the meditation, people come over here and people come to different places. We spend 20 minutes doing it. There's nothing to join. You don't have to buy anything. You're not worshiping anybody.
There's no
really
special clothes you have to wear.
No, none of that stuff. And basically after people do it, generally they socialize and may talk about the information in the case or what have you. The idea is to put everybody's kind of focused on the same thing, which is a peace meditation designed.
How far back does this go?
Well, it's probably millions of years old. And because it originated with the Lyrian, who were the ancestors of the Pleiaren, and who themselves needed it because these forefathers of the Pleiaren developed in highly technological, spiritually developed, but also warlike beings for a long time until they got themselves under control. They were destroying whole systems, and they were, destroying planets and enslaving people in this kind of Star Wars, history, legacy of their ancestors and the Pleiaren state, that they've had peace in their own worlds for about 50,000 years, an unimaginable idea since we haven't had anything but 250 years of peace in 10,000 years on the planet. So this peace meditation apparently is an effective means for people to contribute positive, peaceful energy to help to bring that frequency back to the planet, to forestall wars and destructions and that kind of thing. And the more people that do it, that take the 20 minutes even once a month to do it, the more that charge is present.
Well, let's see if we can add a few million spirits.
It'd be great. We would change the world.
How does this mantra go?
Well, here's the pronunciation, kind of the best pronunciation I can do of it.
Okay.
When they see the words on the website, they'll be able to relate it to this. It's Salome Gamnan Ben Urda Gan Niber Asala Hesperona. Peace be to, on earth and to all beings. Now, that is actually available on a CD that they have in Switzerland where all the people are performing it. You can use it as a kind of companion to the meditation. And I have a link to the Swiss site from They Fly. If people have any questions and if any of this went by too quickly for anyone, they can email me, and I do get around to answering all my email. It just takes me a bit of time because there is often a lot of it. So,
as we do here at X Squared Radio.
Yeah, you know the drill, because you wake up one morning and there's a couple hundred emails you got to, apart from the spam, that you want to return.
Now, this is a synchronized peace meditation that happens worldwide once or twice a day, or?
believe it or not, with the instructions being on the website, it's better if people read how it's done, because I do it with the group that shows up, like at my house in L.A. We do it once on a Saturday, and I know that there are more than one opportunity to do it. There's more than one opportunity to do it, and the times are set there. I've been so focused on just the one time that we do it on the third Saturday of the month.
Is there a feeling that comes associated with it? Like you say, it takes 20 minutes. So I assume you repeat the mantra over and over.
You repeat the mantra at your own rate of speed. You don't have to be in sync with everybody, which
uh-huh.
is also kind of interesting. And you simply try to hold that mantra and that idea of what that mantra means in your mind. I happen to have a real monkey mind that jumps around, and a lot of thoughts are always jumping in on me. I put in my 20 minutes. I enjoy doing it, but I really notice that I'm not one of those people that can just hold that thought forever. So it's not about being perfect with it, or I would have given up long ago. But it is to make that contribution. Again, we're each like little drops in the ocean, and the next thing you know, you do have a sea. The more drops that are, falling into the great basin, as it were. And in this case, you're giving of your attention and intention for 20 minutes towards something that is the most valuable thing we could possibly create on this planet for ourselves and our generations to follow. And that's peace in and all that it means. And too many people think peace is a stagnant, namby-pamby concept. It isn't. Peace is a very dynamic, active, cooperative, evolutionary, creative, fulfilling, prosperous state of being that we're so unfamiliar with that we only equate it with, the 60s or something. And
well,
just to throw one more thought in, we've got our peace symbol upside down, too, according to the Pleiaren.
It doesn't surprise me.
Yeah.
But I see that we in history have not had much peace. May have been peaceful spots on the Earth, but
yeah.
as a planet.
250 years out of 10,000, they say.
That's not a very good record.
Low battering average.
But we have an ability here that we didn't have even 10 years ago.
That's right.
And that is to reach literally every corner of the planet, millions and millions of people at one time we can reach with this message. And as you play back the archives of this program, we want you to go to the website. It's theyfly.com. And our guest tonight has been Michael Horn, who is the domestic representative for the Billy Meyer Contacts. You can get the DVD, The Key to Our Future Survival. I can't think of a single subject of more importance than this. When every day I turn on cable news or satellite news, I'm just dreading to see some new global catastrophe, whether it's a bird flu or some weapon that's been tested or is being threatened by one country or another. And if we could just break out in peace from us exerting, as Michael Horn has said, this little drop of water we can each add to an ocean, maybe we can do what all the diplomats in all the centuries of our existence on this planet have been unable to do. It sounds perfectly reasonable. It sounds easy to do, and I am going to participate.
Great.
As we conclude, I do want you, Earth Explorers, to remember who you are. Every day, you will meet new people. We want you to tell the story and enlighten people. As you play the archives, make sure that you tell others of the positive things that you're, and we'll call them neutrally positive, just to make them align with the show. Next week, we will have open lines and a mystery guest, so I want you to prepare yourselves, study space and Earth news, and come aboard to tell your story and your opinions. In the meantime, we want you to have peace, Earth Explorers, and it's been my pleasure to have you on the program tonight, Michael, and I look forward to speaking to you again. If I don't hear from you on this program, I'll probably see you at a convention somewhere.
Yeah.
I can't wait to meet you. And
I anticipate this. Thank you.
It's been a great honor and pleasure, and we appreciate you being on X Squared Radio.
Thanks very much.
And we will talk to you later and talk to you Earth Explorers later. So good night and peace.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.